Chair.
All right. Okay, the House Committee on Education will come to order. It is Monday, September 16th, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Welcome back, everybody. What did you do on your summer vacation? Hope everybody had a good time. So before we get kicked off, we have a pretty full agenda today. I expect we'll take the full 3 hours. We do need to adopt rules so that we can follow them. I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of adopting rules. Representative Springer.
Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Representative Springer moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion? And just for the good of the public, Richard, is there anything particularly different about these than what we've seen?
Thank you,
before?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee. No, the rules are basically the same from the full session that was just completed. The only thing of note is that there are some filing deadlines for the members. LC drafts have to be submitted by the 26th of November of this year, and then there's some subsequent deadlines. But all the procedural rules are basically the same.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Our higher ed committee this morning, we talked about the fact the committee will have three bills, right?
Yes.
Do you have those? Are you going to seek suggestions?
We do not have those. We'll seek suggestions there. The one that I know that... That was otherworldly. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. But certainly if you have suggestions or ideas, let us know. And we don't have to use all three if there aren't three new laws we need to make. Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. And I will close the work session on the adoption of committee rules. Before we move too far into the agenda, I'd like to welcome Richard to our dais, who's going to be our administrator for the interim. For those that didn't get the opportunity to spend time over in Senate Ed last session, you'll find that Richard is great, fantastic at everything, can answer every question, super organized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking forward to working with the committee, and please, don't hesitate to approach me if you have any questions or need anything from me or from Nick, our wonderful committee assistant. We'd be happy to help.
Thanks, Nick. All right, and with that, we are going to open up an informational meeting on Back to School 2013, what's happening in classrooms, and we have Morgan and Craig. And because I didn't say it yet, if you have a cell phone, please turn it off. Even if it's on silent, it impacts the recording. It creates an interference for those listening on the internet. Welcome. So we had invited COSA and OSBA to come and just give us an overview of what back to school looks like this year in districts across the state. We know we have all of these independent school districts who have similar and unique challenges, similar and unique opportunities, and hope that you could fill us in on some of the good things and some of the opportunities to do more.
Sure. Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Craig Hawkins. I'm the executive director of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, which we know as COSA. And I have the happy duty of telling you that based on conversations with a number of COSA members, including several dozen superintendents, the school year is off to a great start. The resource level that you provided for this biennium has prevented districts from cutting additional school days, laying off additional staff, and the other kinds of challenges that we've faced in recent years. And there's a great appreciation for that out there. In fact, some districts have actually been able to restore days, add back a few teachers or a few programs, and that's really very much appreciated. So in general, I think it's fair to say that the school leaders that are part of our organization really appreciate that you made education a top priority in the 2013 session. And there seems to be a consensus among folks in our organization and among legislators that it's good, let me put it this way, it's good that we all kind of agree that an additional priority, a high priority for education, supporting education, is there, and that we're all working toward the same thing. But I also think it's fair to say that we still have a long way to go. And so I thought I'd share with you a little bit. I've talked with about 50 superintendents over the last several weeks. And really, the question's been about what would you do if you had a few more additional resources, whether it's revenue or savings. And it gives you a picture of why there's still more to do. So what they've told me, by and large, almost without exception, is their highest priority for additional resources would be to add back school days and to add back teachers to reduce class sizes and add programs. That's universal out there. And there are places also that would say things like, you know, if the resources were sufficient, we would also purchase textbooks, technology, and other things that we've delayed in recent years. I thought maybe I'd just give you a few examples of some of those districts. So Bend has said that they would add up to 45 more teachers, and Redmond has said they'd bring back a full school year. Canby said they'd be able to add 4 more school days. Clackam is 5 more. And Oregon City, 7 more, and that's a combination of staff training and student days. This is all based on the conversations that have been around a potential special session. Corvallis has said they would be able to really make a full school year work. I don't know if you're aware of this, but in Corvallis, the way they've been able to get to a full school year in this biennium is to use half of their rainy day funds this year and half next year so that they could offer a full school year. So they'd be able to make that work in a budget sense and also be able to invest in things like the district's one-to-one technology initiative and to add more teachers to reduce class size.
Madam Chair, would you please define full school day? School year, is that 185, 190 days? What is a full school year?
Yeah, a full school year is 185 days. The which
a student on desk or is that counted?
That's combined days of
185. Because what are we down now to 180?
Depends on the district. Some are at 185. Some are as low as, or have been as low as, in the 160s.
And I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Follow up.
Follow up.
But that is not in statute. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Representative Wisnett, Oregon does not have a minimum number of school desk days. We have instructional hour standards that our districts are required to meet.
Thank you.
And that's 990 hours.
It's different for the various grade levels, but I think it's 990, 880, a little bit. I can't remember the exact numbers. Yeah. A little rusty on that.
Yeah.
Oh, and Morgan, because
Morgan
spoke.
Allen from OSBA.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, that's the point, is we want to carry your message back to our district. We need to be sure that people understand. I don't think Ben Lapine or Redmond have had 185 days of school instruction in many years since I've been in the building, probably. So we need to, when we say we want to fund a full school year, what are we talking about? It's important. I'm sorry, but
Chair Gelser, Representative Wisnett, that is really important. Thank you for pointing that out.
And if I may, really quickly, if you remember back from last session, we all did some homework where we went back and talked to our individual school districts about the number of days that were cut out of their year and how many they had. It's probably a good time for us each to go back and ask districts what that number is compared to what they had last school year.
Well, it's nice we got the information that they've added back, and reached full days, but we need to know if that's 185 or that's what they were before it was cut. So,
Thank you.
Chair Gales, Representative Wisdom, I have a number of other examples.
Please continue.
Should I?
Okay. Yes.
Thank you. So 35 more teachers in Taggart-Tualatin, which will help to reduce class sizes, full school years and smaller class sizes in Beaverton and Hillsborough, including hiring a total of as many as 100 teachers.
And this isn't what you've done with the new investment. It's what
what districts would like to do given additional resources and expect to do if they receive the additional resources. New fourth grade teacher in Umatilla. Lower class sizes and additional elective courses in Pendleton. 3 more school days and up to 36 more teachers in Salem-Keizer. Up to 3 more school days in Phoenix Talent, plus 7 new teachers and an extended summer school program in Eagle Point. And up to 6 more days in Eugene and 5 more days in Bethel. And all of this information just goes to the point that I'm really trying to make here is, yes, folks would love the additional resources to be able to take more steps back It's that we've made progress. We thank you for that. There's still a ways to go.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Craig, I really appreciate hearing that, and especially since I have a kid in one of those schools. It's been cutting, and it shows.
Yeah,
it absolutely shows. So as I look at that, and I'm hearing what you're saying there, is this feedback from superintendents of what, maybe a menu of what they could do, what they would like to do, what they have carved in stone that they will do? And then I have a follow-up based on your answer to that.
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, the question was, if you got the additional resources that have been described as potential from a special session, what would you anticipate spending the dollars on? So districts said these are the likely ways we would spend money. Of course, as you know, in districts, you have to go through some processes to get to those answers in many cases. And so, but I think that districts would say this is what we're very likely to do.
Thank you. That, to me, is a very critical point as we look at a special session, as we look, and this is no secret, it's been in the press every day, about the grand bargain and what that can mean, and purse cuts and tax increases and all those things put together to help our students have smaller class sizes, to help our students have more days. And I realize in Oregon we talk about hours, we don't talk about days. And then I look back at, on the heels of a regular session, I think it was, well, it was probably, it's when school districts are doing budgets. So in June, local school district, not in my district, but next door to my district, and do I think teachers are paid enough? No, I don't. But they use the savings for pay increases. And so it was really shifting the money from here to here. And I think that there was some of that used for class sizes and some of that used for teachers. So when I hear things like that, I'm concerned if we're going to take a bigger bite of the apple, if we're going to try to digest that, I'm concerned where that money is going to be spent. If it's just so we can talk about it to move it from here to here, that's not something I'm interested in.
Chair Gelser,
that wasn't a question, I realize.
Yeah, I would say that based on the conversations I've had with, so it's been at least 50 superintendents in the last several weeks on this very topic. It's without question their priority, their emphasis, and really pretty much all they've talked about are days, staff, adding back teachers, primarily aimed at class size, also programs, so, and other really needed investments. That's been the conversation.
And I think just to bounce off what you were saying, different perspective on the salary increases, I think it's hard to tell sitting in a legislative seat what the right use of dollars are in a locally governed school board. I know our district is one. I was very pleased that there were some modest increases for new teachers that we were having a very difficult time holding on to. I know one of the things that is important for my kids is stability and knowing that they have teachers coming back year over year that have been mentored, that have experience, and that feel valued and want to return and stay engaged in the profession. So I think it's always that balance between how do you balance that stability of keeping those experienced teachers and those new teachers excited about the profession and that importance of class size. Other comments and questions before we move on to Morgan?
Thank you, Chair Gelser. My name is Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. And Craig has said a lot of good things, and just a couple things to remember, too. And Representative Wisnett's question about a full school year and the hours versus days is important because we have seen a growth in the number of districts on four-day school weeks. You know, about one-third of our districts have four-day school weeks. And I definitely think there's some districts that would like to go back to the five-day model. And Representative Springer's question about money and where does it go. In order, one of the things we've seen is more money going to salaries and benefits, but that's because districts are buying back cut days, and those were days that teachers took as unpaid days, and so some of that money has gone to salary and benefits, and our boards have seen that as appropriate in many instances because you're buying back a full school year in a calendar and giving kids more contact days. But I think by this time we're all very familiar with the crisis, and our boards are pleased with the increases in resources, and I pulled a couple of examples where I thought there's some things that were really stark that had been reversed. For example, in Albany, this school year is the first time they've had a full school year in 5 years. This year, Umatilla School District, the first time in 6 years they've had have not had to lay off any staff. So they've laid off staff every year for 6 years. And Eagle Point, very similar, haven't had a full school year for several years, and with the resources the legislature gave, they're able to have a full school year this year. But as Craig mentioned, there are still districts that need to go further, because for some districts, obviously, they can buy back those days and cuts in one time. For other districts that have made larger cuts over a sustained period of time, it's going to take more investments and more time, and they're going to need more resources to do that. And Craig mentioned a couple. I'll mention a couple other ones. I thought this was a good example. In Pendleton, in the 2008-2009 school year, they had 315 staff. And this school year, they have 287. And their number one priority, they've been able to keep a full school year, but their number one priority is to start adding teachers back to lower some class sizes. You know, Mount Angel has been, it looks like they've been able to maintain, but they have five planned furlough days over the next 2 years, and they'd like to be able to eliminate those furlough days with some additional resources. And Craig might have mentioned this one. I crossed off a couple that we had duplicative, but Eugene is another district that's taken some pretty hard cuts. With the budget decreases and declining enrollment, they've had six cut days, and they'd like to be able to add those back, and they'd like to be able to add some teachers. And I think the conversation we're having today is important, because there's sort of a sense of relief and almost joy with many of our board members, because many of them, especially the ones that have only been on school board members for a few years, they've never done a budget that wasn't a cut budget, or they've never had a year when they were on a school board when they had a full school year. So that's nice to see around the state. But I think, and you're going to hear a lot from Dr. Saxton and some other folks today, but I think we're still at a tipping point, and there's lots of reasons and ways you can make the case for more resources. But I just throw my two cents in there, which is that the reason that a lot of our board members think we're still at the tipping point is because we're continuing to ask, and for the right reasons, we're going to be continuing to ask to do our schools to do more over the next couple of years. We've got Common Core standards. Our diploma requirements have still not fully phased in, so it's getting harder and more challenging for students to graduate from high school. We've got a new teacher and administrator evaluation system going online this year. There's other changes at the federal level. And going forward, we've got a brand new assessment system coming on. In the next biennium, we have a full-day kindergarten mandate. That's a very expensive mandate. And then the biennium after, we have physical education, another mandate that's very expensive. So it's important that we're going to need these investments are going to need to be more than one-time investments. I think the pattern we've seen too often in the last few years is an investment here and then the money goes away. It's sort of like when you have a grant and then it dries up. You make these investments in our schools and you can't sustain them, so you're taking a step forward and then taking two steps back. And so our members are certainly supportive of the idea of adding additional resources and supportive of the governor's call to bring you folks in here for a special session. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So Morgan, when we talked the other day, we were talking about kindergarten coming up. Could you share a little bit about what you were sharing with me about the fund shift from 1 through 12 to kindergarten that districts are going to be grappling with?
Sure. Thank you, Chair. So in the 2015-17 biennium, if school districts want to offer full-day kindergarten, they'll get a full weight, a full ADMW. And right now, they get a half weight, half ADMW. And so there's roughly, I'm just going to use rough numbers, but there's about 40,000 students per grade level in Oregon, I believe. And so right now, most of those kindergarten age 40,000 kids are in a public school kindergarten. About 15,000 of them are in a full-day program with tuition, or districts have just figured out how to make it work. The other half are in a half-day program. If you switch that over, and now those districts switch to full-day kindergarten, and instead of drawing down a half weight, they're drawing down a full weight, it's like adding 20,000 ADMW to the formula. So you're doubling your distribution to kindergarten. You're not doubling your cost for kindergarten. You're doubling your distribution to kindergarten. And so unless you add additional money to the state school fund, it's roughly, when 5 or 6 years ago, when I think Brian Reeder calculated it at the Department of Ed, it was like $120 to $140 million. My rough calculation is, 20,000 weights at $6,000 a year, that's $120 million a year. If every district went to full-day kindergarten, you're looking at probably somewhere in the $180 to $200 million that would be needed to add to the state school fund so that districts wouldn't be cannibalizing grades 1 through 12. Because if you don't put more money into the state school fund, a little tiny chunk gets redirected from grades 1 through 12 in that half weight to the kindergarten weight. And that's, and many of you know, especially if you have smaller districts or districts that haven't been able to pass a bond, there's some facilities challenges as well. So I think I know that's on the discussion today. I think we're glad you're keeping an eye on that as well.
Thank you. Are there other questions for this panel?
Representative Reardon?
Just a comment, if I may, and at the risk of piling on, it's the David Douglas School District's one I have the most to do with, and absolutely right, they were delighted that we were able to maintain the funding and not have to do additional cuts. They've been doing that for years, but we're doing nothing to add back the 150 positions out of about 800 that have been cut over the years. So yes, we've got a lot more work to do. And one thing no one has mentioned is, and I'm concerned about, is we want to do more for STEM education and career technical education. We want to maintain the arts and the music or build those programs. So, you know, we have a lot more to do than even $100 million or $200 million. Let's shoot for $1 billion.
Any other questions? I had one more. When my daughter came home on the first day of school, she told me that she has 41 students in every single one of her high school honors classes. I know that's better than where we were last year because of the investments that we made. But I couldn't help but wonder how that would compare to what her high school class might have looked like 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Is there any type of graphic that could let us see how that line has changed over time?
Well, Chair Gelser, I think there's two data points we could look for. The first is if you look at spending on K-12 education in Oregon adjusted for inflation over the last 20 years, we're spending less today than we were 20 years ago. And I think you've all seen some graphics that COSA has put together in conjunction with us and OEA and others showing that, you know, a smaller portion of the state general fund and lottery money's gone to K-12 over the last decade. So that's one place to look. And I know there is data collected on teacher and staff to student ratio at the Department of Education, so we could look to that, although that's going to be changing this biennium to try to get a more accurate representation of that question you're trying to answer, which is, you know, not just how many teachers are there for every student, but let's look at, you know, grade 11 science classes, you know, what's the class sizes. And you're going to see, unfortunately, you're going to see some differences across the state. You know, our districts that have generally been able to keep class sizes smaller tend to have more local resources, or local option levies have been able to keep those class sizes smaller.
Thank you both very much. Last chance. Ready? Well, thank you both very much for being willing to come and share with us today. And so next, implementation and compliance with seclusion-related bills. So we have Department of Ed. Cindy and Mike. Welcome. Thank you both very much for coming today. I think the point of today's update was a couple-fold. One, to see how the compliance has been with the ban on seclusion cells and their removal. And then we also passed legislation talking about minimum standards for spaces that might be used for seclusion moving forward, and to get an update from you on how that rulemaking process is going.
Hey, good afternoon. My name is Cindy Hunt. I'm the Government Legal Affairs Manager from the Department of Ed, and I've brought back with me Michael Mahoney, who's no stranger to this committee, but he's the staff specifically assigned to restraint and seclusion matters at the department, and has really been on the front lines taking the questions. So, as you mentioned, yes, the Oregon legislature passed three different bills on restraint and seclusion this session, so we're busy implementing all three. The first one that has gotten attention is the so-called seclusion cell bill. And I know that some of you have seen some communications around that. So the first document that I've handed out to you, and this was also available online for you as well, is that we at the department sent out a numbered memo to school districts on seclusion cells and that bill specifically. And one of the things that we did, just kind of laying out all the requirements in the bill, which was that basically a seclusion cell, if it's contained at a public education provider site, so that's a school district, an education service district, some of our early learning sites also included in that, public charter school, the whole range. If it's a freestanding unit, then the school district or the public education provider was required to stop using it by July 1 and remove it from the premises by September 1. Well, we've gotten some questions on that, and I know most notably was from the Portland School District, and I believe some of you saw some communications around that. Portland Public had seclusion units in a couple of its schools. One of the schools, they removed those immediately, months ago. And then there was another school, Pioneer, which I think some of you toured a couple of months ago, maybe during session. And so that one, there was some confusion. And so they asked the Department of Ed for some guidance and invited us to go up and inspect the cells or the units. And so Michael and I and our assistant superintendent, Sarah Drinkwater, went up and took a look at the units. And it was also for the purpose of implementing a second bill on standards for seclusion units, because this is a new activity for us in Port Oregon. So we thought it would be illustrative to see, you know, some of these units in practice and what they would have that could help us inform the standards and the proposed standards that are going to come out. But in any case, we took a look at them and concluded that they were seclusion cells within the meaning of the bill, and communicated that to Portland. And then, to Portland's credit, you know, they thanked us, and I was told just now that as of yesterday, the units are gone. So that's relatively, you know, within about 2 weeks, all that took place. So one of the things, though, that the Portland interactions told us is that when someone was describing what a unit is over the phone, you get a picture in your head, right? And you don't quite, you get, different people get different pictures. So one of the things that we did with the numbered memo, which is not typical, is we included some pictures. And so if you look at the back of the memo, these pictures I know are pictures that you all saw during session. But for the school districts, you know, they were not necessarily privy to these pictures. And so we wanted to give districts an example of what you intended when you said seclusion cell. And if you look at the pictures, you know, like the first two examples, I believe those were attached to a back wall, although they are kind of freestanding units. And I think in the other example that looks a little closer to kind of similar in size to a phone booth, looks like I can't tell if that's attached or not. But, you know, this was just to give districts some idea of what you had in mind. So since we've issued this numbered memo, we've gotten a series of questions from districts. And I'll let Michael go into kind of some of the themes of those questions.
Yes, Chair Gelson and representatives, my name is Michael Mahoney with the Department of Education, Safe and Healthy Schools Coordinator. There's been two main questions, I would say, and one was surrounding what the definition of a seclusion cell is or a freestanding unit. If you look in House Bill 2756, it talks about that seclusion cells are prohibited, and then it defines seclusion. The student is isolated or prevented from leaving, or they believe that they're prevented from leaving. And based on our conversations with you and amongst ourselves at the department, and based on these pictures, we were assuming that a freestanding unit was one that was bought in, and it either was freestanding on its own in the classroom, or it had been bolted to the wall or the floor. And those were some of the ones we have seen. Well, there's that is not specified in the legislation, so there's been a lot of questions coming up about where does it define freestanding unit in the legislation. So that's been one of them. And the other one has been districts are now calling us and asking us if they've removed the doors from their seclusion rooms, and I'm not sure if they're freestanding units or not. I ask questions when I get these questions, but they're asking if they remove the doors, could they repurpose these rooms and use them for things like timeout, small group instruction, or for children who have sensory issues and need a little timeout to regain composure.
So when we're getting those questions, basically what our response is that the bill does tell you to remove the units, you know, altogether. That doesn't allow for just removal of a door. Portland did take that as a first step, I should say. And one of the things we're sharing with districts is that does make sense as a first step if they can't remove them right away or something, because that does tend to remove some of the health and safety issues with the kids. But those are some of the questions that we've gotten since issuing, you know, the memo. So then another bill that you passed was around standards. So this is moving forward. And so the standards were to go into effect next school year, so 2014-15, and these standards would apply to seclusion rooms. And so the other document that I provided to you, these are proposed draft standards. These will be incorporated into administrative rules that will also implement other provisions of these bills. And be circulated a bit longer than what we usually do for our rules. It'll be about 2 months. And we're going to use a variety of mechanisms to get some input on these standards because, like I said, it's a new activity. And it's an area that we will need to seek input from folks with more expertise in buildings and building code stuff and things like that. So one of the things that we're doing is that we have a special education conference scheduled beginning of October. So Michael's doing two presentations specifically on restraint and seclusion at that conference. The standards will be there seeking input kind of directly in addition to kind of our usual means. The standards, though, that you see in front of you, again, I'll let Michael speak to how we arrived at sort of this initial draft. You kind of have to put something out there to get some comments. But they were based on the Oregon Health Authority standards, but we have altered them a little bit already with kids in mind.
Right. And that's correct. These are the Oregon Health Authority's Addictions and Mental Health Unit that we're aligning these standards with. And there's a committee of folks, a specific committee for physical restraint and seclusion that was formulated when the laws were originally made in 2011, or they were amended, I guess, and updated at that point. And the committee met and we looked at these set of standards, and then we amended them some to adjust them for use in public education programs. And, of course, as we're going along, and we're already getting input before we put it out there, that we're finding a couple things that we do need to further amend. But this is a good start here, as you can see in front of you.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of things of note in the standards. For example, you know, it talks about a room that's 8 by 8 feet and 64 feet square. So the rooms that you're seeing in the example of a seclusion cell would not meet this standard just by space alone, you know, because they were roughly the ones that look like phone booths, I think, I would estimate, I don't know, there may be 6 by 6, 5 by 5, something like that. And then, for example, the ones that were in Portland were a little under 49 square feet. One of the additions we did to the standards is we said also that the walls had to be at least 7 feet across, because if you have a 64-foot room but it's long and narrow, a child can still kind of climb up the walls and those kinds of things. So we've done some adjustments, you know, trying to think about school buildings and kids and, you know, those kinds of things. So then the final bill removed the sunset on restraint and seclusion, so we're continuing to provide technical assistance and guidance and that kind of thing on, you know, proper restraint and seclusion and what's allowed. And then we're also working to implement the data collection piece that was also as part of the legislation. So with that, if you have any questions.
Questions or comments? Representative Huffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not always that we do a good job of expressing legislative intent. This is one of those that I think we did a really good job in the committee and on the House floor of expressing legislative intent to give you the tools that you needed to work with some of the school districts to say, no, I'm pretty sure this is what the legislature meant.
Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, that's why after having a few conversations, and I don't want to beat up on Portland too much, or, you know, it also served as a good illustration, right, because that one school district was kind of out there asking questions, and we started to realize, you know, not all school districts are kind of in this building, and we needed to be more descriptive, and a picture was the only way I could think of to do that. And so the Portland experience helped us to be able to communicate better with other school districts.
Question Reading?
Well, Portland are always good pioneers, so we appreciate that. Just one question on the standards. On E, it talks about door must be open outward, contain a port or shatterproof glass or plastic through which the entire room may be viewed from the outside. Is there any intent to have the person inside being able to see out as well? I mean, I'm looking at this padded room, and if I was in there and I couldn't see out, I'd be freaking out.
Chair Gelser, Representative Bearden, those are good comments. And, yeah, I mean, some of the, and that's exactly why we're circulating this, is for comments like that, right? And some of the rooms we know have cameras, but I'm not sure that the kids necessarily know the camera's in there or know, you know, for sure that it's on. So, yeah, that's a good comment, and we'll take it in.
Okay, appreciate it.
Well, I would build on that. I think knowing it's there is one thing, but that ability to, you know, you're 6 years old and you're in a small space away from everyone else. You can't really hear outside very well. Being able to see someone to know you're okay is important, or to be able to communicate, know that you can communicate that you need to go to the restroom or have water. Representative Sherry, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On E, and that was one that caught my attention to the window piece, I understand pretty clearly. However, it says half doors are acceptable options, as well as where direct visual monitoring can occur. What do you mean by half door? And I'm thinking of the safety of that.
Well, Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, the half door, some schools have described where the wall doesn't come all the way up, and it's usually, I think, between waist and chest high, and they have direct visual monitoring of the student then in that case. And, you know, while that type of a room may not be effective for bigger children or older students, it's something that some of the schools have talked about, and that's where the idea of the half door has come in. But certainly as we circulate this, we'd be open for suggestions and comments from the schools about that.
Follow up. And if I understood, this is something new to me. So there are some seclusion rooms that are 3 feet high or 4 feet high, and that's all that the walls go up to?
No, let me clarify that. It's let's say we're in the classroom and there's a space built over in this corner here, which could be, let's say it's 64 square feet and complies with these standards here. But the wall may not be any higher than this bench you have here, so that the visual monitoring takes place in that way. And those rooms may be used for other things. Sometimes there's just a partition there, so there's several groups of instruction going on in the room. This one place I was thinking about.
Okay. So I had a question at the beginning. It talks about structural and physical requirements for rooms used solely for seclusion. I know in our floor debate, Representative Comp talked about a school using a broom closet kind of underneath a stairwell. Could someone then argue that the standards don't apply to that space because it's not solely used for seclusion? Is there a way to make sure that the standards apply to every space that's used for seclusion?
Chair Gelser, certainly we wouldn't want, you know, something that had been or is a broom closet being used for seclusion because it's outside of the standards. So definitely we're looking at that. The other balance against this is that some of the districts have told us about sometimes like having to seclude a student in the nearest available room. Like, and I'm not talking about a broom closet example. I'm thinking about more like a classroom. And so one of the things we're trying to weigh as well is, you know, if we say solely, then, you know, it doesn't pick up perhaps the broom closet, which we want to. But if we say if it's used for seclusion of students ever, then these standards would also potentially need to apply to potential classrooms that aren't typically used for seclusion. So that's one of the things we're weighing and trying to come up sort of with that middle ground that works.
Is there a way to kind of bifurcate it so that any space has to meet at least these size requirements and the places that are solely have to have the covered sharp spaces or the not sharp spaces?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just thinking, Chair Gelser, that when we do our annual collection, that needs to be specified, the number of rooms used solely for seclusion. So I think in that annual report we'll pick that up, whether schools don't have them at all or whether they are using them.
Are there other questions? I have two more. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification,
Cindy, you've got the proposed seclusion room requirements. So the assumption by the experts is that seclusion rooms of some size or sort are a necessary part of dealing with a certain population. That's the assumption we're working off of. And is there a conversation that on alternatives, what else is available out there in behavioral change and containment?
I'm going to let Michael answer that question because he has been serving as our expert on this area and has direct experience with the school district as well on this topic.
Chair Gelsa, Representative Huffman, the training is required now for districts, as you know, from the 2011 legislation. And in that training, the emphasis, besides teaching staff how to properly restrain or seclude if needed, the main training is on preventing that and teaching de-escalation skills and conflict prevention and crisis response and these sort of things. So one of the things I do, and I know we do in general at the department, is really promote the idea of preventing, intervening sooner, learning what the triggers are for students who are at high risk of behavioral problems, and intervening accordingly so that we can prevent, with the goal, of course, of never having to turn to seclusion or restraint. And you're correct. We are talking about a small percentage of students, I would say, that are having these behavioral difficulties. And a lot of times they're putting classes together, and we're trying to do specialized training with those kids.
And just a follow-up comment, and sometimes it's difficult to sit up here and you appear to be second-guessing the experts out there that have to be in the classroom every day and deal with difficult situations, and I just wanted to put that on the record. It is difficult sometimes to make those, because I have actually been contacted by teachers and said, you really have no clue of what we go through. And so I am appreciative of that, but just trying to get to where we're going with this and make sure that the teachers do have the tools they need to be safe, but the students safe at the same time.
Representative Gorsuch.
In terms of, I see a lot of things in here about protection of ceiling and wall light fixtures, things like that. Is there an expectation that the lights are on when the child is in that room?
Chair Gelser, Representative Gorsuch, that's a good comment, and we will make note of that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it's specifically in here, but I can't say it enough. This is one of the reasons that we're putting these out, because as we do start to think about kids and school districts, it's a little bit of a different animal, and so, you know.
I think we heard in testimony some of these where the lights weren't on, and so mm-hmm. it would seem like that would be something to mm-hmm. add to it. Thank you.
Thank you.
So one of the other questions that I've heard from families that have had kids secluded or adults who have been secluded as kids have to do with the aesthetics of the space. And the idea being the seclusion space is supposed to be calming. But some of these spaces people feel look very mm-hmm. penitentiary style, very stark, mm-hmm. cinder block walls. Do you anticipate any conversation about the aesthetic quality of the spaces when the student is going in, the way that it appears to them or to their peers that are seeing them go inside?
Yeah, Chair Gelser, we have not been, I don't think, engaged in that particular conversation yet, but I do know that with seclusion generally, sometimes it's viewed as kind of a quiet space or calming, and sometimes that's done with colors or like wall colors, you know, and that kind of thing. The ones that I know that I've personally seen, they were a little more stark. They didn't appear to have a color that was being used to calm, other than, you know, the seclusion part of itself. So that may be something, too, that we could look at for the guidance, too, and like how do you do, you know, this.
And have you been, in the questions that you've gotten, have you been surprised at all? Are the number of seclusion spaces, cells, rooms, whatever you want to call them, out in districts, is it about what you expected? Is it a more prevalent practice than what you anticipated when we started the conversation?
I think we've gotten, since issuing the numbered memo, there's been more districts coming forward and kind of admitting or based on their questions that they may have cells than we originally thought. And perhaps they also thought that a cell was more like the smaller room, you know, like the telephone booth kind of room. So they weren't viewing themselves as having a cell until this was sent out. So there's been just a few more districts, I think, coming forward, and that was sort of unexpected a little bit because there wasn't very many districts, I think, in front of the committee, actually, that had put themselves out there to say, yeah, we have these. So that's different.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? No, well, I just wanted to thank you for being so responsive to everyone that has questions, for acting so quickly, for really working to get, you know, the law 2585 was not signed very long ago, and here there already are draft rules. So that level of attention from the department is extraordinary. I also wanted to follow up on what Representative Huffman said. I think when we're talking about these things, we're really talking about architecture and physical spaces. We aren't talking about the people that are working in the schools with kids that have some pretty significant support needs. And I hope that one of the things the school funding task force will look at, that's looking at the state school funding formula. And I think, are you on that one, Representative Springer? State school fund formula? Hmm. Are you on it, Representative Huffman?
No, I thought Rep Springer was.
I think you're on it.
Somebody needs to let me know.
Well, should Representative Springer be on it, or whoever else? I think there's a population of kids that we don't tend to think of. They're not necessarily special ed kids that have very high intensity behavior needs. And my guess when we go into places like the school that we visited is that we aren't giving school districts the resources they need to do the training they need, to have the level of staffing they need, to have the support that they need. Because keeping kids safe is important. Keeping those staff safe is really important, too. It's important work. So I hope it's something we can keep talking about and see progress. I know Eugene put their report out after the 2011 law, and they went from, in the 10-11 school year, they had over 300 instances of seclusion. That's where Jared was from. And last school year, they were down to less than 30. So the focus of staffing and training and the things that Mr. Mahoney talked about can really make a difference. Representative Springer?
If I could just pile on to that just a little bit. Certainly this last session we did some work as far as folks that work with this population, an encouragement basically in the process for reporting injuries, and I think that that's all part of it, because if folks don't feel they have tools, then between here and there, then this safe tool, as it might be viewed by some, can be certainly much more accessible, and I think that was important work as far as providing that heavy-handed request that forms be filled out to help them.
Anything further? Thank you both very much.
Yeah.
All right, breezing right along. Third topic, also the Oregon Department of Education, Mr. Rob Saxton.
You want me to make this motion now?
Sure, and you want to add Julie too? Representative Parrish.
Oh, okay.
Representative Springer, do you have a motion?
Yes, I do. Just a really quick motion.
Oh, I'm reopening a work session on Representative Springer's motion.
Okay. I would move that the rules be suspended. Do I need two motions for each member? A motion for each member?
Yeah, I think so.
I would move that the rules be suspended and Representative Huffman be allowed to vote on the rules that were earlier adopted.
Representative Springer moves that the rules be suspended so that Representative Huffman can vote on the rules that we adopted previously. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to letting Representative Huffman vote? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Huffman, how do you vote?
I love the committee rules, Madam Chair. Yes.
Wow. That's an enthusiastic endorsement. Yes.
Thank you. Representative Springer?
I would make another motion that the rules be suspended and allow Representative Parrish to vote on the rules that were adopted earlier.
Representative Springer moves that the rules be suspended so that Representative Parrish may vote on the rules that we adopted earlier. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Parrish, how do you vote?
I will vote yes.
Thank you very much. She votes yes. And with that, we'll go back to
House Education Hour with Rob Saxton.
Yes, thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. It's great to be here this afternoon, and it seems like summer flew by. I know that this is one of my very most favorite times of year, and it has been, I think, ever since the day that my mom lined me up and took my pictures. I wandered off to kindergarten with my sister. And I think we all kind of can remember those days. As an educator, over the course of my career, it's been a time that I've always looked forward to greatly. And I think it's about having special plans in place and having thought about all the things that are going to happen up in the upcoming school year that's going to make a big difference for kids. And this year, I've had the great opportunity to go out to a number of school districts across the state and visit in the first couple weeks of school, and I'm looking forward to doing that some more over the course of the entire school year. And there is a renewed sense of hope and optimism in schools in the state of Oregon, and I just want to thank all of you for the good work that you did in the regular session around the significant increase in funding and the savings that were created through PERS that school districts are now able to put into traction around delivering services to students and changing what their school years look like, the class size, the offerings that they have. Really and truly, as I talk to people, there is a sense of relief and a sense of gratitude for the work that you all did. It was a very heavy lift. I would also tell you that as I go out and meet with folks, they also want me to hear what they would do if they just had a few additional resources. And that almost always is what steps into the conversation. I was down in Klamath Falls City Schools and County Schools last week, and just as you know, both COSA and OSBA talked about when they were up here with Craig and Morgan, what would you do if you had a few additional resources in the upcoming school year? And I hear things like, well, we still are short a few hours or days, depending on how you want to talk about it, and we would add those back over the course of the school year. One of the questions I always want to know is, so if those funds came to you this school year, could you use those to best effect? And the answer, of course, is always yes. And things like, we have some blends, or really what they wouldn't want to call them blends, I'd get in trouble with the elementary teachers, but we have some splits in some of our schools right now where we have class sizes of, say, 32 in second and third grade, and it's a combination of second graders and third graders. And we'd like to pull that split apart, and the numbers work where if we could just hire one more teacher, we could do that, and then we would have just second graders and just third graders in our classrooms, and that would be really beneficial. And you sort of have to see what that looks like when you're putting together a schedule, but it makes a significant difference, and something that's really easy to do at this time of year. Or secondary schools who say there are some really rich classes that we could offer in the second semester, or some classes, some of our AP or IB classes where we have really big class sizes, 52 in a calculus class, and if we could split that right now, it would really make a difference for students. So there's all kinds of opportunities around that, and I know that people are really hopeful that there can be a special session and that perhaps there'll be some additional dollars that will come to schools. So with that, I'd like to launch in a little bit more into the scripted presentation that I have for you today. This month, I'm into the 14th month that I've been in the department now, and not that I'm counting or anything, but I'm very pleased with some of the work that we've been able to accomplish over the last 14 months at the Department of Education. We really want to turn into a service organization for schools, and so really what I have on the screen there is a list of some of the things that we have done, with the adoption of a new mission, a strategic plan that aligns to, that begins us on a trajectory toward reaching 40-40-20 in 2025, and it aligns with the OEIB strategic plan. The investments that came out of the most recent legislative session that we have a great deal of excitement about, and I hear a lot of excitement about across the state. The implementation or the bringing in of the Early Learning Division and the Youth Development Division into the department, where really now we're really pre-birth through grade 12 at the department, and as a big part of creating a system of P through 20 that coordinates things in a different and more efficient way. We set forward a set of metrics in our strategic plan that were six-month metrics, and I'll report on what we accomplished on those today, and we feel really good about the work that we've accomplished there. And then also, we reorganized at the department, and we announced that. We've been working on that reorganization since last January, and we announced and did it in August of this year, and so we created a new, what we're calling the Office of Learning, and the Office of Learning is focused around student and student learning, and that office is made up of our Office of Equity, our Office of Standards or Curriculum, whatever you want to call that, our Office of Assessment, and then also our Office of Student Services, which is special education. And so those are the core areas around which instruction takes place, and we see that those need not be siloed or should not be siloed. Instead, those should be a collective that work on student achievement and then with support around those and business function and so forth. So we're very excited about that. And lastly, something that's not on the slide is I feel like the people who've been able to join the Department of Education in the past year are some of the best and brightest educators around the state. And you'll meet at least one or two of those today, and I'm very excited to have them on staff. We heard from the field really clearly that they wanted people who had school experience, who understood schools, and who understood that when a rule gets made or an interpretation is made or when they're asking for help, how schools work so that we can do a really good job of actually making our decisions and our efforts work on behalf of students. And so very pleased about those things. I talked just briefly about the strategic plan. We had 37 six-month metrics in our strategic plan. I wish we hadn't called them some of them six-month metrics because some of them couldn't be delivered until like right now, like the kindergarten readiness assessment where we said all students would take it, and it took about 9 months to get that done. But we are on track to meet all of these by mid-year this year, all 37 metrics. 21 we met in 6 months. The other 11 took a little bit longer than 6 months because that was when they were scheduled, like the kindergarten readiness assessment. And so all but three are really on time, and we feel good about that. And again, those are things that are scheduled to take us on the trajectory of 40-40-20.
Can I ask a question? Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
Not at all.
You reminded me. Somebody stopped me recently at a meeting and said, so what does a kindergarten assessment look like? Because most kindergartners can't read coming in. And I said, you know, I don't think we've ever talked about that in any of our hearings. So can you give us an idea of, is it one-on-one verbal? How's this done?
Right. Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, yes, it is one-on-one verbal. And really we're looking for early numeracy or math skills and early literacy skills, like can you tell me what that letter is? Can you tell me what sound it makes? And it might be an A, you know, or can you count to 10 for me? Those kinds of things. And so there's a series of prompts and that kind of thing where it really is an assessment where the kindergarten teacher sits down with the student in the very, very first days of school because we want to know how they arrive, not what they're learning once they do arrive. And so when I was in Klamath Falls recently, I got to meet with all of the kindergarten teachers in the district one afternoon, and they gave me some feedback about the assessment and what it looked like for students to take it, how they'd organized it, how they'd sat down and given it. And so that's kind of the academic part of it, if you will. And then there's about a three-week observation period where the teacher watches the child and the kinds of behaviors that they exhibit. Do they, you know, can they line up? What are their social interactions like? Do they think to raise their hand? You know, all kinds of different things like that that also are reported on that are sort of school-like kinds of behaviors. And so that is about 3 weeks, and then they sit down and write out their observations or mark their observations for the student, and that's the collective of the assessment.
Follow up. So are there some, at least in the initial assessment, are all Oregon kindergarten teachers asking about identifying the same letter and the same sound and the same color? And
Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, yes, the assessment is the same basically for all students, the same question, same expectation. And what I heard from the kindergarten teachers in Klamath Falls was it was amazing that the students either knew almost all the answers or none. And it really was an indication of kindergarten readiness, which is what we're trying to find out about.
Thanks.
Are these all intended to be done the first time that the teacher meets the student? I heard from a local kindergarten teacher that was concerned that that wasn't the right way to get to know her student, to do that the first time he walked through the classroom door.
Chair Gelser, it does not have to be given on the first day, the first time that they meet. I know that some districts have chosen to do that because they want to do it and then get on with the other activities in kindergarten. That was one of the conversations I had in Klamath Falls as well, is that there is a time frame. We wanted that to be as early as possible so that we could truly know how students showed up. And so, but really what it says is, if I believe anyway, is that the assessment has to be completed within the first 3 weeks. And so a lot of districts have chosen to look at the academic component of it very early, which we think is appropriate, and then the behavioral part over the course of the 3 weeks. But you could give that assessment at any point. And so it really is a district choice.
Representative Gorsuch, were you trying to get in there?
Oh, no.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you.
So I wanted to give you a little bit of an update on House Bill 3232 and 3233. So what we put into this, and of course it's really small up there, I know, but you may have it in front of you as well, and I'll talk about it and not get too specific, but during the session when 3232, which was... you know, the strategic initiatives for student success, and then 3233, the network for quality teaching and learning. When those were in process and we began to recognize that there was a high likelihood that there would be support for these in the legislature, we put together a group that included folks from OEIB and at the Department of Education and began thinking about, you know, how would we get these out effectively? How would we make sure that they're put to best effect? How do we operationalize this? And, you know, the what is kind of the OEIB and the how is the department. And so this really was on our shoulders. But, you know, we've worked in partnership with OEIB since the beginning. And so the information of the what and the intent and then how to get that actually working out in the field was really important. And we knew that the intent was that with the start of this school year, much of this would be underway, and that if what happened was we got the resources and it didn't impact this school year in a really important way, that we would be a year behind what we intend to have happen right now with some of the reforms that we have in place. And so it was incumbent upon us to, you know, work through the process of what are our core principles about what it is that we're attempting to accomplish, how would you write an RFP so that you get delivered what you want, who would have an opportunity to respond, just the whole gamut of what that looks like. And then as soon as those bills were signed into law, we had many of these ready to go. So we didn't want to have dollars for teacher mentoring, for example, and have new first and second year teachers and administrators show up at the start of the school year and have districts not know if they had mentors or not. And so we needed to get some really quick turnaround on some of those things. Small school districts were concerned that they might not have the grant writers or the wherewithal sort of to respond to some of these. And so we made sure that ESDs had some funds to help with grant writing and to lend grant writing to some of our small school districts, to which they've availed themselves significantly. So we set right to work trying to get these things out. What I would tell you is that we typically give out these kinds of funds in a 49-51% split, so 49% in the first year and 51% in the second year, just like the state school fund, so that it's sustainable over the 2 years of the biennium. And what I would tell you is we got out 51.5% of these funds will be in the hands of school districts or other providers by October 15th, the available funds for this year, right? And then the rest of it will be out in around two and around three. And what we've tried to do with this is talk about what the initiative is, how much money it was, and what round it will go out. So round one means that funds are either already in the hands of school districts or will be by October 15th. The second round of RFPs will be out by October 1st, and then dollars in the hands of school districts before the start of the new year. And then the third round will be RFPs will go out in early December and be in the hands of school district by about February 15 in anticipation of the hiring season for the following school year, and then also any kind of extended opportunities for students where you would have a summer school or an after-school program so that districts have these dollars and begin their work right away. And I just... I'd like to commend our folks at the department who have really had to work on this, and that's procurement to a really huge degree, and they've done a wonderful job of getting contracts out and getting reviewed by attorneys and so forth and getting this stuff moving. And so I'll talk about a few of the specifics on these here in just a moment. There were... some other dollars also that came out of the last legislative session, and so there's 3233. So like the physical education grants, and that was established by House Bill 3134 in 2007, and those funds could be used for two different purposes, and there was increased funding for this out of this last session. And so it can be used to hire elementary PE teachers, but also hire... do some staff development for some of our small schools and our I'll spit it out here in just a second here. charter schools, there we go. And so we got those dollars out, and 19 districts, 47 different schools used the Hire the Teacher grant, professional development grant, 5 districts and 11 schools on professional development, so a total of 24 school districts and 58 schools. I know I've talked to some superintendents who called me up and were very excited about the fact that they got this, and they said, we're, you know, immediately posting these positions. We want to get these PE teachers hired and in place as quickly as possible. And so $2 million allocated to that funding over the course of this school year, and then an additional allocation in the next school year.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Dr. Saxon, is there maintenance of effort required for those grants? We have to maintain that after the...
Chair Gelser, Representative Wisnett, I do not know the answer to that question. So I bet you there's somebody back there who can come up here in just a second and answer that question. But it may take a moment. Here we go.
Hi. Welcome. And if you can state your name for the record, that would be really helpful.
I'm Tanya Friesendahl, Education Specialist at the Department of Education. And I'm sorry, what was the question?
Is there
maintenance of effort?
Yes, ma'am. When the grant runs out, are we supposed to, obligated to keep it running?
So in the assurances that districts do sign, it does say, you know, to the best of their ability, that if they accept these funds, that they are to attempt to continue providing that level of professional development. And also in 2017-2018, these minutes are going to be a requirement, a district requirement. So, yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We'll stay for a minute. You never know. Okay. As long as you're up here. Okay. Thank you. The mentoring program, and I talked about that just a little bit, and that was part of House Bill 3233. And see, this is one that you know about as well. But this is one that we wanted, again, to get out very quickly. There are more new teachers in the state this year than there have been in a very long time. And so we got the turnaround on these grants very quickly. And we awarded to 16 different either districts or consortia, and 76 districts are participating in these grants. 1,132 first and second year teachers now have mentors. 135 first or second year administrators now have mentors in the state. We allocated just over $5 million for the 13-14 school year, and we have $4,000 for the new beginning, for the beginning teacher mentors, and $3,800 for the beginning administrator mentors. This is a really exciting program. People are hard at it already, getting their mentors in place and making sure that those people are as supported as they can be in their first years of teaching and or leading.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Madam Chair, we had discussion about whether, how did it turn out as far as some schools didn't want to pay the whole amount. How did that shake out?
Are you able to give people less money if they want less money?
Unfortunately, districts really need to have an addition. I mean, the 4,000 and 3,800 was a reduction of about 20%, and most districts were asking for the 5,000 level per beginning educator funding level, so they did have to modify their budgets to meet the new allocations that we gave them.
So I guess no.
I don't know if that answered the question.
I'm sorry.
So I think we had a bill, mm-hmm. and the bill related to mentoring grants, and there was a specific dollar amount that I no longer recall that had to be awarded to the district.
Up to 5,000.
Up to 5,000, and some districts wanted less than 5,000, but they couldn't take less than $5,000. Has that all worked out? Are you able to give people what they need?
Yes. Districts and consortiums can request whatever beginning teacher, beginning educator, administrator allocation that they feel would meet providing an evidence-based program, which is what the statute reads as funding for an evidence-based mentoring program.
Thank you.
Yes, I apologize.
Representative Gorsuch.
Just really quickly, and this has probably been documented somewhere else, but what are the qualifications for mentors? How are they selected?
Districts each have in their application, they outline exactly what qualifications they are looking for when they are selecting their mentors, and they go through a variety of different approaches. I know in Lincoln County, they videotape them, the mentor that is applying, they have provide a videotape to the selection committee. They are interviewed. They have references and application. So the process is very stringent.
Okay, so there's a fairly good vetting of, it's just you can't just say, hi, I want to be a mentor, and they go, okay, great.
Correct.
Okay,
yes.
Excellent.
Yes,
thank
and
you.
That is outlined in each of their applications.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Chair Gelser, one of the things about this is we had indicated that, you know, 85% of districts that applied with new teachers for these grants, that 85% of the teachers would have mentors. And then people hired more teachers, and so that's why it went from 5,000 to 4,000, quite frankly, is because there are enough new teachers, and we want to meet the 85% or better, and about 86.5% of new teachers in those districts that applied now have mentors. Okay. CTE revitalization grant. So in this particular grant, we had $9 million in grants and administration award. And this is a career technical education, and it is really a partnership. I work with Brad Avakian on this, and you can see these are the people who are on the grant committee. This is the group of people who review the RFPs and make the determination of where those grants are awarded. And I'm sure that you'll see on there that there's a healthy list of folks from both business and education on that selection committee, and those dollars will go out. And I know that we had great success out of the last session with those CTE revitalization grants, and we anticipate that this will be very good as well. Those dollars will be out and in the hands of school districts by December of this year. And the applications are due back in October. Let's see. Or was I going the wrong direction? And we also had the CTE Education Student Leadership Organization grant, so that was $735,000. Those grants are scheduled to go out right away. This is a grant that the dollars go to a foundation, and $500,000 of the dollars go to a foundation, and then they go to student leadership like FFA, DECA, FBLA, HOSA, and the like, and those will be in the hands of school districts.
Excuse me, please.
I'm sorry, of the student organizations, very quickly.
I have to interrupt.
Representative Reardon, I was worried that you
this
were
this is legal down. Now. It's just signed into law maybe 5 minutes ago, so you are absolutely accurate today.
All right. Well, I know this is something that we've been working on, and I was talking to folks just outside the of the room before I walked in who said, we can tell them that these will be out within, you know, actually in the hands of these organizations within, you know, probably a week, week and a half or something like that. So very,
very,
very quickly
news.
Anyway. So that's good. And then FIRST Robotics, $635,000, and those grants released in August, and then will be delivered to school districts by December. Full-day kindergarten. I'm going to switch up a little bit and talk about full-day kindergarten. I know I heard a little bit from Morgan Allen about full-day kindergarten earlier today, and this is a bill that was passed in 2011, Senate Bill 248, and it offers full-day kindergarten beginning in 2015-16. And I use the word offers because I think you all probably know that districts are not obligated to offer full-day kindergarten. It just is if they do offer full-day kindergarten, they would receive full funding for the students. So right now, a student goes to kindergarten, whether it's a half day or full day, the state reimburses at half the student cost. So 0.5, we would call it average daily membership weight at ADMW. And if in 2015 a state offered full day kindergarten, a school district offered full day kindergarten, then the state would fund that at a 1.0 ADMW. There's no requirement to offer full day, and so I know that I would assume that most school districts will offer full day. It also, when the law goes into effect, school districts will no longer be able to charge tuition for full day kindergarten, and many school districts currently do charge tuition for full day K. There are other things that go along with the implementation of full day kindergarten besides just just its implementation, I think kind of have a list of some of the steps that we need to go through at the department around rulemaking and communication and so forth. But even more importantly, really, is the idea of school districts ensuring that the curriculum they actually deliver during kindergarten is different than the curriculum that they've delivered in a half day. Many school districts have gone through that effort because they have some full day and some half day, or maybe they've just decided to go all full day at this point in time, or none. Those who haven't have some good opportunity to work with districts who have implemented and look at the way that curriculum looks. I know that when we went to full day kindergarten in Tigard Tualatin, the next step for us was then changing the curriculum in first grade, which, while it's some work, is one of the most exciting pieces of work that you can ever have to do, because you're saying that students are going to arrive at first grade different than the way they arrived at first grade previously. And then you have to rewrite the second grade curriculum, and then you have to rewrite the third grade curriculum, because students aren't the same if they go to a half day as compared to when they go to a full day. And so districts will be doing that, and the Department of Education will be supporting that work over the course of the next few years. And it is also an opportunity to align that curricula to the Common Core set of standards, which is new. And I think sometimes when people think about the Common Core, they think it's just a high school curriculum or a high school, middle school, and it isn't. It's a preschool curriculum even. You know, and it's not a curriculum. It's a set of standards. My curriculum people are dying back there when I say curriculum. It is a set of standards, not a curriculum. So that goes all the way up and down.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Saxon, what are the current, how many hours is a half a day kindergarten now? And how many hours in a full day kindergarten provided now with tuition and state funding?
Chair Gelser, Representative Wisnett, at the risk of being wrong by a little bit, elementary, I believe, is 880 hours of instruction. That's what the minimum is required for elementary.
Including kindergarten.
And kindergarten is half that. It is at least half that, or under half.
Oh, like 3 hours is half a day. Is that instruction? Is that?
One of the challenges with half-day kindergarten is that if anything sort of interrupts that day, like, you know, just getting into class and settling down, or if you decide in your half-day kindergarten you're going to offer a student an opportunity at something like music or PE or something like that, and districts do all different things in that, that looks a little bit different if there's going to be a recess period and so forth. So all districts are a little bit different in the actual number of, you know, classroom instructional hours. And sometimes when kindergarten teachers talk about this, they want to talk about how long was the child in my class today. And so while, you know, PE and music are instruction, very much so, they, you know, sometimes say, well, I only had them for, you know, 2 hours and 30 minutes today or something like that. And it's a very short time period. And it seems when you go to full day kindergarten that it grows more than just the additional hours that get delivered, because it accounts for some of those kinds of things on a percentage basis. It's a much bigger piece that's at sort of the core content instruction.
Representative Wisnett.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. Thank you for that information, sir. I've always been concerned about full day, especially for rural Oregon, the time. And I was an advocate for extending the half day to a day at, you know, three quarters or something, because you're there, you transport them, and that's a big part of the thing. Also, would you comment on are you going to look at that and successes in other states like Oregon that has a large rural population? And also, to me, what we've done here now is I think that rural schools are going to be using it less, and your urban schools are going to want more full time. So you're subsidizing those schools and for their children at the detriment and less funding for rural schools. Could you comment, please?
Chair Gelser, Representative Wisnett, you know, you may be much more in tune than I am to that particular question. To be honest with you, when I'm out in rural Oregon and I talk about full day K, I haven't noticed a difference in the way that rural Oregon districts have talked about it, at least to me, in reference to, sort of the urban areas. It's been my sense that there are a number of reasons why people may or may not engage in full-day kindergarten, although I think the vast majority will engage in that. I haven't noticed the difference between rural and urban, with one exception. Unfortunately, when it comes to, a lot of people want to talk about space, when we start talking about full-day kindergarten and how we're going to get this done. Unfortunately, about just under 100, I think it's 86 districts last year had declining enrollment, and they're actually, oddly, sort of perversely, a space in those districts that have declining enrollment, and oftentimes that is rural. And so it seems like when you talk about the space issue, there's a little more space in rural or perhaps for full day K than there might be in some other areas. But that is a point that I will take to heart, and I'll begin to have some conversations about what that looks like between both rural and urban so that I understand that. And if there are some barriers, I would certainly want to remove those to the best of our ability.
Follow-up statement. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Saxon. Your staff can tell you that I've discussed declining enrollment for 5 sessions.
So. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay, thank you. So another new thing, I've already talked about the kindergarten readiness assessment a little bit this morning. The one thing that I wanted to really stress is that this is the first time we've been able to do this across the state, and all students are taking this assessment, and it really, I believe, is giving us the kind of results that we need to know, and that is, are students ready to be successful in kindergarten, and are they not? And then we can begin to track what kind of experiences have they had prior to kindergarten that can tell us a little bit about that. And in many districts where they have not had this kind of an assessment or a pre-assessment previously, we believe that teachers will be able to look at what students know or don't know and then move their education forward from there in a really nice and coherent way. And so this has been a big important piece of work. Once we get the data in, which will be about 4 weeks from now, we'll begin immediately to try to figure out how to put it together, make sense of it, and create some measurement about what is ready for kindergarten and what is not ready for kindergarten in reference to the results that we get.
Representative Reed.
Thank you for all of this, but the assessments themselves, what form are they given to kindergartners? Because I don't know if it's pencil paper, is it computerized, is it one-on-one, or...
And we covered that a little bit while you were out of the room.
Sorry.
But...
I had to go.
I think we have time for a brief refresher. A brief refresher.
I can catch him in the hallway.
Representative Green, it is a sit-down one-on-one with the student, with the teacher working with the student on a series of questions.
That's more than enough.
Okay, thank you. And I want to introduce to you, who's going to talk a little bit about focus and priority schools, Lisa Harlan. Lisa is new to the Department of Education over the course of this summer. We stole her from the Corvallis School District. We apologize to Representative Gelzer, where she was principal of Lincoln Elementary and previously had been principal at one of their middle schools. And Lincoln Elementary was one of the model schools that was identified, that was a Title I, high poverty, full immersion, language immersion school, and she is a catch for us here at the department, and I'm going to let her talk a little bit about priority schools, and I can push the button.
Awesome. Thanks, Bob.
And if you introduce yourself for the record, and just briefly, it is a real gain for the department and a loss for our district. I got to know Lisa when she was one of my kids' vice principals. This is a person that knows the name of every student in her building, knows what they're doing, knows where they're going, and is really the kind of person that we need leading us in the state. So congratulations to you, Rob, and sadness for us.
Thank you.
And for the whole state, I hope. Congratulations.
Thank you, Chair Gelzer, members of the committee. I'm going to talk a little bit about focus, priority, and model schools in Oregon, give you an overview for how they're identified and then some of the supports that the state is offering these schools. So priority schools, it's important to know that when we talk about any of these are all Title I schools.
Lisa, you have to say your name for the record, please. That's okay.
My name is Lisa Harlan. I'm the Director of School Improvement, the Department of Education. All of the schools that we're talking about are Title I schools. So high poverty schools. So it's important to know that, look at it through that lens. So priority schools are Title I schools in the state that are in the bottom 5%, bottom 5% in terms of student achievement and in terms of student growth. There are 33 schools that are priority schools. They were identified in the 2012-2013 school year, and you retain your rating of focus or priority school until the 2015-2016 school year. So there's a cycle of 4 years that the state will engage these schools in a process of assessment and making plans, implementing plans of improvement. 17 of those priority schools are SIG schools, the majority of which are high schools that were part of a federal grant for a school improvement grant. Focus schools. So focus schools, so priority schools are a priority. They're in the bottom 5%. Focus schools are in the bottom 15%. Again, high poverty schools. And those schools are needing to focus on something. A lot of times it is achievement gap or subgroup growth or achievement. It could be graduation rate as well. There are 56 focus schools in the state, the majority of which are elementary schools. The reason the majority are elementary schools, it's much easier to get a Title I designation as an elementary school than it is as a secondary school. So that's important to note, too. If someone were to look at these lists for focus, priority, and model schools, they would think, why are there more elementary schools than secondary? And that would be why. It's important to note, too, for focus, priority, and model, you'll really see, and I'll show a little later, that they're kind of scattered throughout the state. They are represented both in urban districts and rural districts alike. Model schools. The difference, model schools are identified each year. So each year, the department identifies the top 5% then of Title I schools and their performance. There are 27 this year that we actually will be sending out notifications and identifying them here in the next week or so. So that's always exciting. It's better and more fun to do that than the other. And out of these 27 schools, there are 5 districts that have more than one model school in their district. And so that's something of note, too. That's not easy to do. So here are focus, priority, and model schools by poverty level. And one of the things that I think is fascinating that you'll notice are some of the highest poverty schools are one is a model school and one is a SIG school. But you'll see the distribution in terms of poverty. Those poverty level is based on free and reduced lunch rates. So I think the lowest is down there, close to 30%, and the highest, of course, being 100%. So all of the students in that school on free and reduced lunch. Map of Oregon. The red are the model schools, and the focus and priority are blue and green. And so as you can see, we have them all the way out in rural Oregon, a lot down the I-5 corridor. But just a great map to show you where all of those schools are. So in terms of school improvement, what are the supports that school receives? I said a little bit before about kind of this cycle of assessment, self-assessment, school improvement planning with stakeholders and then go on this implementation journey. One of the major sources of support are coaching. So each school principal receives a coach. They meet with them weekly for up to 10 hours. School support teams will also come in 4 times a year to help the coach and the principal look at the plan that they have and how are they doing and how does it need to adjust. The first year is really focused on planning and professional development for staff, for principals and teachers alike, and looking at what they need to do to move forward and getting them the training and the professional development to start to implement some of these plans. And so it's just that continual improvement process really that we're engaging schools in. So the first thing kind of I asked when I came to the department was, how did it go and how did we do? And so what this shows, all of the focus and priority schools and their change in rating. So focus and priority schools, generally speaking, there's a rating scale in Oregon, and they're usually level 1 or a level 2. Some of our SIG schools were rated higher. But what this shows, if you look, 0 means no growth, that over the course of a year that they were rated the same from 1 year to the next. 1 and 2 means that they jumped in rating levels, 1 rating level or 2. So you can see that there were some schools who were rated as a focus or priority school that jumped 2 ratings. Overall, the thing that was exciting for me to see is over half of our schools in a single year, focus and priority schools improved their rating. I think it was 51.6%. So in a single year, I think that that's that was better than I would have anticipated or guessed. And this just kind of does the breakdown for focus and priority. 46 of those 89 schools improved their rating in a year. And it just shows if they were focused priority, what their rating was and what their rating jumped to.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very nice. This is it's interesting, the focus and priority schools are a result of us getting the federal waiver. from No Child Left Behind. And yet it really provided us with an opportunity at both at the department and then across the state to look at some of our underperforming schools and say, how do we develop a process that helps you improve your outcomes with students? And let's be really intensive about this. There's an expectation to do it. Let's do it really well. And so we've taken this on, and we're starting to see some results, and I think that we're going to see even better results as we move this year into the implementation phase for the changes that districts are and schools are intending to make. And so very excited about that. So I did want to talk a little bit about proficiency-based teaching and grading and House Bill 2220 and the OAR that goes along with that. And I think that I gave or had passed around a draft, and it doesn't say draft all over it like things usually do, and it should, a draft of an email that I'm intending to send out as soon as I get some feedback from people on the committee, and not necessarily in this setting, but over the next day or so, if you could get me some feedback on that letter about what it might happen to say, then I will be sure and get that out. And it really is an effort to try to be clear about what 2220 does and does not say. I heard a quote actually when I was in Klamath Falls that Albert Einstein said that if you can't explain it easily, it's because you don't understand it well enough. And so I've worked pretty hard to try to understand exactly what 2220 does and does not say, so that I can be really concise with school districts, because I know there's a great deal of confusion. And when I see some of the communications that have gone out, it surprises me and disappoints me that we didn't communicate earlier harder and better. And perhaps it was just a matter of not understanding it well enough yet. And so I think we have that down. So there really are two requirements for school districts. And the first one is that one time a year, the school district needs to issue a report to the parent that says, here's how your child is doing in comparison to the academic content standards in this course. So if I was a high school math teacher, I might have seven standards. And I could say, your child is meeting or exceeding on the standards. Or I could say, on those seven standards, they exceed, meet. And then I need to assign an academic grade that is about that standard. So I would say if they exceeded on five of the seven, that they probably have an A on the academic content covered in that class. And so I would issue a grade if I was a secondary teacher that said, your child exceeds on the standards, and they have an A on the standards, and I may not include behavior in the designation of that grade. After that, the law really doesn't speak. It doesn't, and nor does the rule. It doesn't say what behavior is or is not. It doesn't say that you can't issue some other kind of grade and that that grade couldn't end up on your transcript as the transcript grade. It just says you have to do two things. How'd you do compared to the content? And what's the grade that goes along with that and is not influenced by behavior? Now, districts, we're going to give you as much flexibility as you possibly could have. You have the ability to say, and that's the grade that's going to go on the transcript, or you have the ability to indicate a different grade. And I think it meets the intent of the law, because really, I think part of the question was, a student graduates with a 3.95 GPA and then goes to college, takes the placement exam, and ends up in developmental education or remedial courses, whatever we want to call them. And how is it possible that my child got a 3.95 and ended up in developmental ed? Well, your child may have exhibited lots of really good school-going behaviors. They might have dressed up on dress-up day, brought canned food into canned food drives, and created an extra diorama when they needed to turn in an assignment, and so they got a lot of extra credit. But it doesn't mean that they necessarily had the content down. And so as a parent, if I get a grade that says your child has an A in the content and they got a B on the transcript, it tells me that they got a 3.0 in this class or whatever, but they have the content mastered. And when they go to college, it's likely that they won't be in a developmental ed course if they go on to college. And if my child got a C on the content but got an A in the course, I know that they probably exhibited lots of other behaviors besides what content is, and they may end up in developmental ed. That's the intent, and by describing it that way and trying to be really specific, these are the two things you have to do. All the rest of that, that's up to you. If you decide that behavior has something to do with turning in a grade late, or not showing up on time, or you know, any other myriad kinds of things that you would want to consider, and you want to calculate that into a grade on a transcript, you can. But you need to tell the parent how the child did compared to academic content.
So can I ask two examples of things that I have hypothetically heard that is required by House Bill 2220? Number one, House Bill 2220 requires that student grades in high school be based only on summative assessments.
Not true.
And that homework be entered in the grading system with a 0% weighting.
Not true.
And that House Bill 2220 mandates that if you miss school on the day of an assessment, you can retake the assessment on another day if you've turned in all of your homework for which you've got no credit, but you can't get more than 75% on a retake.
Not true. So the thing, Chair Gelser, the thing that I hope that has resulted of this, and as a matter of fact, when I go around the state and talk to people, I know that it truly has, is that districts and schools have had really interesting conversations about grading as a result of this bill. And I think it's a conversation that is overdue. And that is, how do we want to think about this? And can we all, as a school, agree on the way that we're going to issue grades? Can we have a conversation about that and do that? And because there is a high level of attention being paid to this, it might behoove us to have something fairly standardized so that when parent-teacher conferences roll around, we don't find ourselves in the uncomfortable situation of trying to explain some of those sorts of decisions, right? And so there's a lot of flexibility, but there are two requirements. And I don't know, you know, if I am continuing to not explain it well enough or clearly enough, but those are the two things that you must do. And beyond that, there's all kinds of flexibility that you have. I hope that you can come to a common understanding about how you're going to grade at your school and deliver those grades so that parents understand what you're doing.
And so would it be accurate for us to say, I don't know if others have gotten many, many, many communications from constituents about this issue, but would it be accurate to say if they're concerned about homework, if they're concerned about attendance, if they're concerned about the transcript grade, the legislature didn't make any mandates about that. The school district, the school board, the superintendent has all the authority in the world to decide how they're doing their transcript grades and whether and how they grade homework.
That is correct. Exactly.
And there's nothing in the law that says that their transcripts or their report cards have to be different.
That's correct. All it says is you have to deliver this report with these two considerations on it. You know, how they did in comparison to the standard and what grade you assigned to that absent any behavior impacting it.
And that doesn't have to be on the report card.
That's correct. They may choose to put it on the report card, but it does not have to be. It doesn't demand, it doesn't dictate proficiency grading. It doesn't dictate any kinds of things. It says, give them the grade you want to give them, but give them these reports so they know what their child knows in comparison to standard. So I don't know how to say it any more clearly exactly. I know that I have an opportunity to meet with all superintendents this Friday, and this is on the agenda for me to talk about. So not only will they get an email, but they'll be able to ask me questions similar to those that you have just asked me, and I'll be able to answer clearly because I think I now understand it well enough to do that.
Representative Reardon.
Is it fair to say that the bill really takes away nothing from what the...
Chair Gelser, Representative Reardon, correct. It does not take away any ability for a person to issue a grade exactly the way they always have. It just requires two other reports to go to the parent and student.
Okay. Sounds simple now.
And for all the freshmen on the committee, you did not vote for this bill. It was in 2011. Any other comments, questions? Thank you for clarifying that. I would have to say that I've heard more about this bill than any other. I've never heard from as many students and parents and others so loudly as I have the issues around House Bill 2220. I think there's been a lot of anxiety for high school students, certainly in my district, and I've heard from other students in other parts of the state as well. So the clarifications, I think, will be very helpful, and I hope students hear that and know that they probably should turn in their homework.
And Chair Gelser, I appreciate that, and I know that we now understand it in this room. Now it's our job to make sure that it's understood across the state.
Thank you.
Set to work on that. I did want to talk just real briefly about Smarter Balance. I think it's the last thing that I have on the agenda today, and of course I'll be happy to answer any other kinds of questions. But Smarter Balance, was selected as the assessment for the state of Oregon, and this is an assessment that will assess students in comparison to the Common Core standards. And we will have a field test this coming spring, in the spring of 2014. In that field test, 20% of Oregon students will take the assessment. So that means that there are two parts of the assessment, English Language Arts and Mathematics. So 10% really will need to take English Language Arts, and just English Language Arts, and 10% will need to take the math assessment to give us our 20% of all students having taken at least one part of the test. So that's what we're looking at. We have a meeting coming up with districts to think about the exact way to roll that out and have students participate in that. And we need that to make, just to make sure it's all going to work right, and so that we can set how the outcomes of that assessment compare to the current Oaks assessment, so that we can draw some conclusions about how those two match up or do not, but we can say that this score is approximately this score on the two different assessments, so we understand what that looks like. In 2015, the Smarter Balanced, the real test, the operational test window, will be underway. Those assessments, students will be able to take it only one time. In the past, on the Oak, students have been able to take the test three times. Last year, it was only two times. On the Smarter Balance in 2015, it will be once. And that test will be given near the end of the school year. If you're third through eighth grade, you have to have attended 66% of the days, according to the rules set forward by the testing consortia. Mm-hmm. And if you're a junior in the final assessment, you need to have attended at least 80% of your days. So that means that the assessments will be given late in the spring in both cases. Students who are juniors this year, who take the Oaks assessment and need to pass it or something like it in order to be able to graduate from high school, will be given an opportunity to take the Smarter Balanced the next spring in 2014-15 around demonstrating graduation requirements, and that is just sort of a little technical thing that we're working through. There are some a variety of different kinds of accommodations that are on the Smarter Balance. So what we have here is a really small list of some of those. And when I say small list, I mean that the writing is small. But we have a list of some of the accommodations that districts are able to, or that are on the test. So there are some universal ones like an English dictionary, a highlighter, a strike through, that kind of thing that all students have. Then there are designated supports, and those are those that are suggested by or asked for by an adult. It could be a parent, a teacher, or an IEP, someone who's on a student's IEP. That would be things like text to speech. So it could be that the test would actually read basically what is in the text for the student. Could be things like translations and other kinds of modifications. And then the last section there, the documented accommodations, would be if a student was on an IEP or had a 504, and that includes things like American Sign Language and closed captioning. So it's an interesting assessment, and there are some accommodations for students. And that concludes my comments today. Unless certainly there are questions, I'd be happy to answer any.
There are questions. Mr. Huffman.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. Rob, I just wanted to pass along, Dr. Golden was in our higher ed meeting this morning, and you mentioned Common Core, and she had mentioned something in her presentation, and I asked to make sure, because coming into the business of the legislature, you make certain assumptions that things are going on out in the world, and then you get in here and attend all these meetings, and you find out that for some reason we continue allowing students to graduate from high school and get a diploma, and they go apply to college and then have to take all sorts of remediation, or whatever the new term was that you used. They used that this morning too, but I'm going to use remediation. And I said, so with Common Core, is K-12 and higher ed communicating so that we can use this opportunity to to stop that insanity and make sure that more of our students, if not all of them, are prepared to enter into higher education. And she said that that conversation was going on. I just wanted to get it on the record here, too, with you guys to make sure that it's always been a frustrating concern of mine, and I think all of us up here, how we can keep churning out diplomas that aren't ready to make the next step when we've got 40-40-20. It just doesn't reconcile. So.
Yes, Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, you're precisely right, and it took me a long time to say developmental ed also. It took me almost 11 months, I think, but as opposed to remediation. But it is really important that that lines up. One of the things that I'm excited about with the Smarter Balanced, because it's a consortium of, I think, 26, 27 states, is that there's a lot of conversation right now about how these results on this assessment should translate into higher ed, and that's actually a conversation across the nation, where we say, okay, if a student scores X on this assessment, what does that mean for higher ed? What does that mean in Oregon? And I think we need to come together and have that conversation in Oregon so that we're really clear about it, and it adds kind of some value to this, especially because this assessment is supposed to compare students to college and career readiness standards in a different way than we've ever had, because Oregon standards haven't really been about college and career ready. The new standards are. The new Common Core standards are. And then what does that mean maybe across the nation? Can we develop a consortia understanding around that? And there's lots of conversation, a great deal of work around that, and I'm very hopeful that it will mean things about what it means to when you go from high school to college and you're able to say, and here's what I did on the Smarter Balanced Assessment, because it tells something about how college and career ready I am.
Additionally, I met with one of our regional presidents the other day, and you had mentioned the grant funding for robotics and FIRST and all that stuff, and the emphasis on CTE and STEM, and the emphasis on needing more engineers. And the president was telling me that as we're working, I happen to be on one of the work groups or task forces for accelerated credit. And so as we're looking for dual enrollment, dual credit, AP, and all the things that we try to do, he said, as we're putting more emphasis on STEM, it's incumbent on high school counselors and whatnot to make sure that they're guiding possibly engineer-oriented students into the math and not just directing them into the transferable general ed, because they end up coming to us with a lot of credits that really aren't going to apply to an engineering degree if they go into an engineering program at Oregon Tech or OSU or whatever. And so, you know, wanted to get that out too, that we are making changes, and with the different emphasis that we have in areas like STEM and engineering, it's really important that that message is integrated, so we're not giving an 11th or 12th grader wrong instruction and direction, and then they get where they think they're going to readily step into a higher program, and they weren't given the right information.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. Any further questions, comments? Representative Gorsuch.
Not to rain on your parade, this has been a very helpful discussion, but I've been teaching at the community college level since the mid-90s, and what we've heard over and over and over is that we've improved our standards and our students are going to be better, and at the community college level or at the university level, because I've taught at both, we still haven't really seen that. And I know that teachers are trying very hard, and I know that students are trying very hard, but, you know, we were promised this with SIM and CAM and all of these wonderful things, and that really didn't seem to benefit our students. So I'm just worried that we're just going to go through another exercise that really isn't helping our students. And I'm not trying to blame anybody. It's just I hope this isn't another exercise like that.
Chair Gelser, Representative Gorsuch, I would agree with that exactly. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned a lot about this year is that transition really from high school into college and making sure that The content that we give students access to is college and career readiness content. So I cannot go to college and be successful in college if you don't teach me the material or if you don't give me access to the material that I need to know in order to be successful. And too often, especially for students who are not signing up for advanced courses, we teach a course and the student may get an A or a B in the course and assigned onto their transcript in the course. And what we find out, though, is that the content that they learned does not have them be ready to be successful once they leave high school. So they're going to get a diploma, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to be able to step into an AA program and do the math I need in order to be successful to get a job around, you know, anything that has to do with that, or that I'm going to be able to go to the college. And when we're awarding college credit at the high school level, we need to make sure that the content that they're learning and that they can deliver on is actual college content, and it's a very important consideration. And so those things are required and needed. The thing that I like about this that's different than anything I've ever seen before is that we spent a lot of money and resource in the state of Oregon to create standards. And they were good pieces of work, but they weren't a big national discussion. And with the Common Core, this was a discussion that happened across the nation with the best minds coming to bear from college, from community college, and from K-12 to say, what is it that students need to know and what do they need to be able to demonstrate in order to be successful in college and career? Now let's identify those standards and create a trajectory so that over the course of a child's learning experience, that trajectory will have them learn the knowledge that will have them college and career ready at graduation. And that any other kind of a target is an unacceptable target. That's what the Common Core really does and sets out. And it is, you know, it was a national discussion and a national group that came together and said, this is it. We are going to be definitive about it, and this is going to be the target in all states that sign up to teach to that set of standards, and Oregon did. And is one of about 46 states that did that. And so that's why I'm really hopeful that this is different and that that set of standards is more accurate. Now we need to make sure that we have the skill to teach to that, and then we'll have an assessment that tells us how we're doing against it. The assessment probably is the least important part. It just is a dipstick of how are we doing, but it is an important thing for us to look at and a big piece of accountability.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for coming and bringing so much information. So our next topic is about, we've called it shortened school days. We're really learning what this topic is. In the last session, in the regular session, we did some work on student discipline and exclusion, and we talked about the importance of keeping kids in school rather than putting them on a path to suspension or expulsion. So one of the issues that's been raised by the good folks at the Juvenile Rights Project and Disability Rights Oregon are some kids that are seeming to fall into some sort of another world before exclusion that is kind of like home instruction but maybe has them out of full school days for a longer period of time. So the goal for the hearing today is to try to better understand what the issue is for everyone that's here to hear the description of what these things are. I know that the department and districts and all of the partners have been trying to figure out what do we call this problem, how do we figure out the scope of the problem, and it seemed like the best way to get there was to all be in one room and hear the information and some specific stories. So with that, Joel, do you want to bring your team up?
Yes, I was on it, not in education.
Thank you for being very patient as we move through a pretty full agenda today.
Representative Geltzer, members of the committee. My name is Joel Greenberg. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon, where I mostly work on special education issues, but also deal with other issues that affect people with disabilities. And DRO is the protection and advocacy agency for the state of Oregon that protects the rights of folks with disabilities. But as I said, our work tends to spread out more broadly than that, and on occasion intersects quite a bit with youth rights and justice, Brian Baker, who was going to speak for you thrice and Justice had to leave because of child care issues, but you have his written statement. I have with me also two folks today.
Which is on OLIS. His written statement is on OLIS.
I have two folks with me today who are going to speak probably more powerfully than I do. One is a parent of a student who received shortened days, and she's going to talk about the impacts on her family and upon her child when that was done, sort of the specifics of how it occurred and what it did to her and her child. And her name is Marie Donnelly. And the other person here is Joan Cushing, correct? Who is a CASA, a court-appointed advocate, who represented or worked with a student in a different but similar in many respects situation, and she's going to talk about the same kinds of things. I'm not going to talk much longer, but I am going to tell you that the reason we're here and the reason we think you need to understand this is based on our own experience, our caseloads, our intakes. And what we've noticed in recent years is that a large portion, an increasing portion of that caseload has to do with students who, for one reason or another, are not children with medical needs that require that they receive tutorial instruction or can't go to school, but nevertheless are excluded from school. And it happens in a variety of ways. Some of these children receive tutorial instruction typically for only 5 hours a week. And again, these are children who should be attending school, but generally, although not exclusively, because of their behaviors, parents have either acquiesced or been strong-armed or actually agreed in some instances that it's not worth the pain of trying to send a child to school all day when the behaviors are not well contained, controlled, or understood. So this kind of problem is understandably increased as resources in schools have been more and more strained, and this is kind of where the rubber hits the road. These kids are hard to deal with in many instances, and one of the ways that schools deal with it, unfortunately, not always for good reasons and not always for bad ones, is they just say, you don't get to attend all day. So the models for that are sometimes tutorial instruction 5 days a week, probably more often shortened school days, and this affects mostly kids with special education disability needs, but not exclusively so. So schools will send children to school and say, all right, we have a duty to educate you, but because of whatever issue it is, and it's often behavior, how about half day, or how about an hour and a half a day, or how about an hour of tutorial instruction and an hour at school? Needless to say, after having listened to Dr. Saxton and the other speakers today, you could imagine that these children are already at a disadvantage and that their trajectory towards college or towards a good career or towards an independent and productive life is pretty heavily impacted by the fact that not only do they start out at whatever disadvantage is causing the problem, but they're not getting to attend school. They're there only for a few days a week. Anyway, based on these kinds of observations, we joined with Youth Rights and Justice and contacted Dr. Saxton in June and told him of our concerns and asked ODE what kind of data or information they could give us about the extent of the problem. I have to say that ODE responded very positively. They were not aware of the problem. They were interested. And when they looked at their data, they were essentially unable to tell us the extent of the problem. On Friday, however, we did get some information from ODE. They were able to tell us that apart from students who receive tutorial instruction because of medical issues, last year 704 other students received their instruction in the form of tutoring.
704?
704. We suspect, but do not know, and ODE does not know, how many students fit in the other kind of scenario that I talked about where they're not getting tutorial instruction exclusively, but they instead attend a shortened school day. So there are a couple of issues here. One is we don't think this should be going on, and the other one is that because ODE was not really aware of this problem, it hasn't been on their radar, they've not been measuring it, and they don't have data that would allow them to measure it at this time. We suspect that over time, when we have a better handle on what the extent of the problem is and what its impacts are, that we will be coming back to you for legislation or rulemaking that will either restrict or constrain this process and make sure that if and when it's used rarely and used appropriately. Frankly, although I think the case would be stronger if the numbers are big, and I think 704, even as a partial number, is a big one, it's a tragedy even if the number is very tiny, because, again, we're talking about students who start at a great disadvantage and are the row they have to hoe. The road they have to hoe is going to be a very difficult one if they're not allowed to attend school and aren't receiving instruction. That's not going to help them. So with that, I would tell you that I've sent you written materials that include a more coherent version of the statement I just made, a copy of the letter we wrote to Dr. Saxton, a case study of a parent who did not want to appear here because her situation and the situation of her child was embarrassing to her, and another case study that Youth Rights and Justice sent to you. With that, I don't know what order would make sense. Perhaps I'll have Ms. Cushing start first and tell you about what her experience was in this problem area.
Welcome. And you might want to pull the microphone over closer to you. And even though you've been introduced, you need to state your name for the record on your own, too, please.
Representative Chair Gelsler and members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak. My name is Joan Cushing, and I am the CASA for an 11-year-old child. When this child was 4 years old, she was removed from her home, and for the next 7 years, she's been bounced around in temporary living situations, desperately wanting a real family. Last December, she was moved from Portland to a group home with developmental disability for children with developmental disabilities in the Mid-Willamette Valley. The following month, she was placed in an EGC, emotional growth class, with 12 children, one teacher, and 2 to 3 aides. The primary disability on her IEP is emotional disturbance. In the new school, she soon began showing physical aggression and was often sent home and suspended for a number of days. This happened repeatedly. Eventually, the school decided to only allow the child to attend for 45 minutes each day. This included the time she entered the building until the time she exited the building, and it also included a 10-minute snack break in the middle. She was placed in a room with no other children and 2 or 3 other adults. She received approximately 15 minutes of instruction a day. Most of this time was taken up in testing. On several occasions last spring, we requested to have her classroom time extended. We were hoping for her to be allowed to attend school for at least half days. At our last meeting in May, the school agreed to give her an additional 10 minutes. Currently, she is allowed to attend school from 7:55 to 8:55 a.m. daily, hardly allowing any time for meaningful learning to take place. Her teacher has stated numerous times that this child is unable to focus for more than 15 minutes a day, and I don't think that's true. If her day could be extended longer, time would allow doing several 15-minute blocks with breaks in between if she needed them. The school committee offered to provide her with at-home tutoring, but the director of her home stated that this child very much wants to attend school, and remaining at home with a tutor would cause her to feel like a failure. My CASA child wants to be in a classroom with other children where she can build friendships. Being away from other students is painful for her and doesn't allow her the chance to develop normal social skills. The aggressive outbursts at school are real. Teachers have been scratched and bit, and this is horrible for them. Possibly with better training and more resources for the teachers, some of the aggressive behavior could be avoided. Being sensitive to her triggers and knowing when to switch to a less stressful activity is key. This being said, she's unquestionably a difficult to manage child but she's not an unmanageable child. In conclusion, I would say that she needs more classroom instruction and the opportunity to build friendships with other children in school. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So maybe we can hear from both of you and then we can have questions.
Sure. Okay. My name's Marie Donnelly. And I wish I could stand because I'm a stander. But this is Shane Musket. This is my son. This is a couple years ago. I don't have a recent picture of him right now because actually as of Thursday, his father passed. And so I'm preparing for his funeral right now.
I'm sorry for your loss.
So I'll try to get through this the best I can. Shane is sweet kid, kind kid, loves animals, highly intelligent, but he has social problems, difficulties with social, picking up on cues with other kids. So what Shane has is they put him on a partial school day, and Shane's been the kid that he has triggers, and he tends to retreat when he has a trigger. And basically, if I really wanted to come in here, and I really wanted to put on a dog shot collar on everybody and hook it to a hammer so that every time you verbally had a noise, you'd feel the shock that he feels every single day with every loud noise, shutting of a door, the screeching of a car, every little thing makes him have physical pain through his entire body. The lights, fluorescent lightings for him when he walks into the school is like being in a strobe light. And then for this kid, he has all these sensory issues, but he's a kind, loving, gentle kid. And he's been misdiagnosed as having behavior issues, but it's really sensory issues that trigger him to retreat, go underneath the table. He's now 13 years old. He's rolled himself up in carpets because of being embarrassed from being told to say you're sorry like you mean it. Well, things like that for kids on the spectrum, those things don't get that in a social aspect like we do. That comes natural for us. But for them, saying I'm sorry is a big win for him. And anyway, so with Shane's sensory issues, he's been put into closets, all kinds of places, and said that he's, you know, a bad kid. But really, that's not the case for Shane. If he wasn't followed down the hallway by a teacher saying, take your hat off, and he's just thinking to himself, I just got to get myself to the next room where there's not those lights flickering, then he'll take his hat off. But not being able to verbally communicate that. He can verbalize, but because he's not able to say, hey, you know, the lights are driving me crazy. Can you just give me a break? Can I just take it off when I get to classroom? He just scurries along because he doesn't want the conflict. And he's been gotten in so much trouble for things like this because the teachers don't get it. I've told them time and time again, and they just don't understand what it's like to have sensory issues at all. And we've had so many different people try to help, but it just doesn't seem like they understand what it's like for him. So he starts his day off on a special school bus to get to school. He only gets to be there a few hours a day because rather than nurture Shane and steer him away from bullies and things, the teachers actually instigate and make it worse and bully him. Now, in their minds, they don't realize that they're doing this, but it's because they're not educated to understand what it's like to be a person with all these sensory issues going on every day, all day long. You don't ever get to take that shock collar off and get a break. It's always there. You don't ever get to get away from those lights that flicker. You can't take the shirt off that scratches and makes you feel awful and everything. It's just crazy. Anyway, with a shortened day with Shane, I've never been able to hold down a full-time job for anybody. I've had to work for myself. I've had to put my business, which I'm a hairdresser, into our home so that I can be there. And if there's a moment's notice where the school says, hey, he's not doing good today, he needs to go home, which happens 4 to 5 days a week. I get a phone call every single day to go pick him up because they can't handle with it. They can't handle him. He's hiding under a desk. He's hiding under the bleachers, which is all very, the bleachers are dangerous. They're afraid they're going to collapse on him, but he just wants to retreat and get away from all the noise, the lights, the visual, everything that's going on. He's very intelligent, and one of the ways he retreats is he reads. He reads and reads and reads. Bill Gates is one of his heroes, who, may I say, is another Aspergian. And if we don't educate Shane, we're losing another Bill Gates. I'm telling you, all these kids are so super smart and intelligent. We just gotta figure it out for them, because they need this education, not just for them, but for us, for all of us as a society.
So what is the structure of his day right now? Is the plan that he goes every day, all day, and it's shortened because you get called? Or is there, what are his current planned hours?
He goes into school, and while he goes into school a couple hours late. And this, there really is no reason for this, but they just think that he needs a shortened day. So he goes in a couple hours late. He goes in and he checks in. He goes to a resource room. And then they'll send him out to different classrooms and back to the resource room during the day. But in normal classrooms, the transition between class between classes is very difficult for him. So he'll go in, but he'll leave when there's not class going on, before and after classes start. So he's not in the middle of all that stuff, that sensory stuff that's going on. And then he usually is there for an hour or hour and a half before I get the first phone call of the day. Shane's having a rough day. You need to come pick him up. Now imagine I'm doing someone's hair color and I've got bleach on your head. What am I going to do? Can you just keep him can you try to calm him? He's crying. He's upset because one of the teachers said, stop tapping your pencil. Well, when you got sensory issues and you can't stop wiggling and you got to do this and you got to do that, just to focus. I'm sure many of us remember that time as a little kid where there was that one thing you had to do that you just couldn't stop doing, and the teacher got mad at you, but you just couldn't stop doing it. That's Shane. And he's not doing it to bother anybody else. He's doing it to center himself. And so then I get the first call then. And so, okay, we're going to give it another 15 minutes. You know, Shane, let's try to calm down, and let's try to, you know, go to the office or go to your special place that is a quiet room, not a containment room. But he needs a room with natural lighting. There can't be any the sensories going on. He needs it to be quiet. He puts on headphones that are quiet. And he doesn't need to have stimulation, people walking in and out. He just needs a little time to settle himself down. And he gets calm, and he's able to go back to class and handle a few more hours. But there are certain days, many days, that I get a call, and they just say, just come get him. We don't want to deal with this.
So I represent Shane. Just to clarify, he is not scheduled at all to be in school for a full day. He's scheduled to be there about close to a half day. But as you've heard, he rarely manages that. And I'd like to just emphasize, there's a spectrum of children who are being affected by this. We heard from Ms. Cushing about a child whose behaviors are threatening, aggressive, difficult. Probably could be handled a lot better if the teachers had more support or there was more resource available to figure out the right way to handle the behavior. But admittedly, that child had very difficult, concerning behaviors. Shane's behaviors are threatening to himself in the sense that, you know, he might hide in an inappropriate place. But I can't tell you how many IEP meetings I go to where, you know, people would be dying to have a student in front of them who wanted to read all the time. So what this kid does when he misbehaves is he retreats, he hides, and he reads. He's not throwing chairs. He's not tearing apart furniture. He's not threatening people. At his very worst, a meltdown is a very large child who's miserable and crying and wants everything to stop. That's not every child we're talking about, by the way, has a disability. A great number of them have not been diagnosed or have not been found eligible and insured. But the problem extends also to children who have no disabilities or are no diagnosable disabilities. But this is a problem that's occurring, we think, with great frequency and increasing frequency, and it's something that I hope and think you folks should be interested in.
So who? So where there's this plan of this day, has there been a process like an expulsion process or a disability manifestation hearing, or is it an IEP placement? How does it get? How does this happen with the safeguards that are in place around school time and placement, kind of across the, I know it would be different for a kid with an IEP versus a kid without an IEP, but what's the process for having, you know, an hour? What did that meeting or discussion look like?
Thank you, Chair
Gessler.
In our case, there was a school meeting with the teacher, several teachers, and the principal, and special ed teacher also, and I was there, and we had some other representatives there, and pretty much the teacher said this is what they needed to do, and that was it. And they said they would meet again with us in about 6 weeks, and we'd talk about getting more time, but each time we would meet again, well, the last time we got an additional 10 minutes, and that's pretty much it.
That would be pretty much how our IEP meetings went.
Well, and that's with the advantage, hopefully, of having a trained lawyer there. I mean, we may be looking at a due process case at some point, but that's an expensive and difficult undertaking. It's a big commitment for a parent to make and for my organization to make. There are other ways that this happens. In this case, we're not talking about a child who was expelled or disciplined, but simply subjected to the IEP process in a way that said, well, we have behaviors. The child's having a difficult time in school. He'd probably have a less difficult time if he was not in school as much. All of his problems are in school, so let's cut the school. Needless to say, I did not accept that point of view. I argued pretty strenuously against it. There's been an IE in this case. There are a lot of ups and downs and nuances that I think would bore you to tears. But the net result is we've increased his school day a bit, although in the practical effect of that has not been large to this extent because the supports in place are still not adequately implemented to ensure that even the partial day he's supposed to be getting is one that he actually experiences. The other way that this happens, which I think, Chair Gelser, you were alluding to, is for children particularly with aggressive or difficult behaviors that run afoul of disciplinary codes or cause property damage or frighten people or make them uncomfortable, they're subjected to discipline, and there may be an MDT or not. I've talked to a lot of parents where it doesn't happen the way it should, but even where it does, you're talking about a child who is either expelled and then given special education. That's part of the IDEA requirement, is that even when a child is expelled, except for very rare circumstances, they're still entitled to special education that allows them to access curriculum and make progress. But the way that's typically done is, here's a placement we have for kids who have run afoul of our disciplinary code, and even though you're not expelled in the way a child without a disability would be, you can go to online school. You can get an hour of tutoring a day, or we'll allow you to attend some other location for, most frequently, a very short day. So this can happen for through a disciplinary route. It can happen through the IEP route. It can happen through none of the above, where the school principal typically, or the vice principal in charge of discipline, will simply call what they may call their special committee or whatever, and they just say, John's having a lot of trouble. We think he'd do better if he were here 2 hours a day. And one of the peculiarities of that kind of solution is that if you have a student who has 10 incidents of self-injuring behavior a day, if you cut his day in half, they very frequently have 5, and the data therefore says this really worked great. We've reduced those behaviors by 50%. We've also reduced his ability to learn by 50%. So does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you. Are there other questions for this panel? Representative Parrish.
So we didn't, I didn't catch which school district is your child in. I don't think that was mentioned.
Mine. Mm-hmm. He's in the Gresham-Barlow. And I think that kind of the point of today, I think that the issue is, and we talked about it, it's kind of scattered in districts all over the state, not necessarily, as it's been explained to me, a particular district.
That's right. It's very widespread in the sense that we get calls and cases from all over the state where this is a problem. It's also a national problem. Other PNAs are reporting it's happening with increasing frequency. I've only seen one very informal kind of study based on intake calls where a Michigan PNA estimated that this is the primary complaint in 9% of the cases they deal with. So we're talking about potentially a significant number of children. Something that I forgot to mention was that when we spoke to ODE about the data they could supply us, and I've explained to you some of what that was, one of the things they have no idea about is of the students who are receiving shortened days, even when they're reported, how short those days are and for what duration are they on that kind of reduced schedule. Now, I can tell you my experience is that many students are subjected to a shortened day for certainly more than 4 months, often a year, and occasionally multiple school years. So I've had students who have received shortened days or tutorial instruction for up to 2 years. That's kind of the upper limit, generally, not because the school successfully reintegrates the student or not, but because by then things are so bad that something else happens, referral to juvenile justice, parents lose custody, parents move.
Representative Reardon, I think you were in the queue.
I'll go ahead and save it for some other day.
Okay. Representative Parrish?
I do want to follow up. So, I mean, I guess, what was the school district's justification to you to actually say, we don't want your kid here for part of the day? I mean, I'm just kind of curious how that conversation went, because there are protections for children, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me that they could legally come out and say, you know, your kid needs to be here for a compressed day, and we don't want to deal with it.
Well, it's interesting. It's a hard thing to say. We'd have his IEP meetings, and basically they let me know that we're the team. Now, the team consisted of myself, Shane's attorney, and as many of the school staff they could get in there. And they basically told me the majority rules. Well, this is what the team's decided collectively as a group. And I said, I don't agree with that. And I've signed paperwork that said I don't agree with what you're saying, with what you want to do here. And they've just basically said, well, this is what the team decided. Too bad. And I have we have our attorney. He deals with this stuff every day. And we just don't have any recourse.
We do have a legal recourse, which is a due process hearing. We have another one, which would be a complaint to the State Department of Education. In some instances, I'm not sure this one would apply, maybe an OCR complaint.
OCR is?
Office of Civil Rights. But what I can tell you is that an ODE complaint in a case this complex, where a number of educators and or administrators are saying, we think this is a good program for this child. It's allowing him to progress educationally. For instance, his reading scores are going up because he reads all day. His testing is not bad. He's not behind his classmates in, I think, any but one of his major core areas. So they're saying, well, he's doing fine. you know, he's not developing any social skills and he's a wreck 4 to 5 days a week, mm-hmm. but under the very strange requirements of the federal legislation, mm-hmm. he's arguably getting a FAPE, a free and appropriate public education. Mm-hmm. I think that's a laughable contention to make given mm-hmm. what's actually going on, but to fight that really does require, in this instance, a due process hearing. And although I am busily positioning myself to do that if I have to, that requires experts. You know, it's very similar to a trial. Mm-hmm. And I'm dealing here with a parent who's just got a death in the family. You know, she's got a lot to deal with. And before taking on a commitment like that, I have to determine whether my organization and she collectively have the resources we need to stick that out and do anything about it. And school districts, frankly, they have an advantage in this kind of situation because that's a calculation that's always at work. And, you know, they are in control until that control is wrested from them. They also have some legitimate concerns and arguments to make in each of these situations. You're hearing from an advocate who sees it one particular way. But the part I can tell you with good authority and without being worried about my own objectivity is, were I to decide that this requires legal action, I have to think about whether there's any way to do that with a practical chance of winning and at an affordable, that it could be done in an affordable way that's available to both me and the parent. And that's a rare situation.
Representative Reardon.
Could you tell me just some idea of an acceptable remedy to this?
For this student or
yeah,
in general?
Or maybe more in general would be, because we're talking about the topic in general.
Youth rights and justice, as I said, is not here. We overlap in many ways in terms of what we think would be a good remedy, but we differ slightly. Both of us agree, both of our organizations agree that ultimately, this is a problem that's going to require, I think, a legislative or rule fix that simply curtails the process of shortening a student's school day unless there are more protections available to make sure that it's not used inappropriately, that it's not used, this kind of remedy is not used before other solutions are explored. For instance, is there a more creative way to support the behavior, the teacher? Can we bring in an expert? What's it going to take so that this student is not crying and melting down? Now, I can tell you that one suggestion would be we'll put those earphones on him. He won't wear them. So some kind of set of rules and or legislation that would make it more difficult to do this and put more scrutiny on how it was done and eliminate or reduce the process where parents are simply forced to acquiesce to it. I think we both agree, YRJ and my organization, that ultimately is the solution. In the interim, however, I think it would probably be important that we develop a way to find out how big the problem is, how many students this affects, how many students who it affects are suffering this kind of loss for a short period, a medium period, or a long. So we need data. And I think ODE has frankly been cooperative and interested in deciding how to do that. I'm sure that it'll turn out to be a matter of dollars available and how many of them it will take to do it. But I think they at least agree with us in principle that...
And we'll give them a chance to say what they think.
We need to find out the dimensions of the problem. So that's step one. And once we do that, I think then we could have a clearer and better idea of what an ultimate and realistic fix would be.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch.
So I have a question for you. In terms of this team, I'll use that loosely, are there any medical people on that team?
You mean in these particular cases?
On his case.
No.
There has been, except for they're not in the meeting. And there was one of the persons that I really wanted there was, he's got a psychiatrist, mm-hmm. he's got two therapists, he works with twice a week, and but he had a skills trainer at school, and this woman was amazing,
She really did well. She was able to kind of refocus him when he would kind of get a little off and get a little down. She'd get him refocused, and this woman could get him to go through a full day. But the school said I said, well, I talked with her early in the school year last year, and I said, we're going to have Shane's IEP, and I'd really like you to be there. And she said, I want to be there. Make sure you let me know. A couple weeks later, I'm looking for her, asking the school, and they said, she's not going to be here anymore. I said, well, can I get a hold of her? And they said, no. And I said, well, I want her to be at the IEP meeting. And the principal said, no, she's not going to be there. And I said, well, can't I have whoever I want? And they said, no, she works for the school, and we don't want her there. And she wanted to be there. So we've been cut at the knees.
Follow up. Have you taken this to the school board?
The head of the school, head of the disability
special education
director was there.
Really?
Yes. And while we had that meeting, during that meeting, one of the teachers sat there and knitted the whole time, which I have a picture of her doing.
So, and maybe you two can talk offline. I think I want to refocus us back to the more kind of the general 704 kids, which Shane's story and your CASA child story, I think, really helped to put a picture on the spectrum of kids that we're talking about: passive behaviors, aggressive behaviors, challenges to be sure, but shortened time. How long has the child that you've been representing, how long has she been experiencing less than a full day of school?
Well, Chair Gelser, she started at this school in January, and I'd say the shortened day started about 2 weeks later.
And was she on a shortened day in her prior placement before she moved to that school?
She was not on a shortened day, but she often, on her own, didn't make it through a full day. She was in a place where she lived, and the school was on the campus, so it was easy for her to go back and forth, and she probably took advantage of that a little bit too much. But her plan was full day.
Are there other questions for this panel?
Just one real minor.
Yes.
And I don't know if you can answer this. When the school sends a kid home early, do they still collect payment based on a full day?
Okay. Just not sure they do. And we don't know. One of the things we don't know, because the data is really not there, is whether in specific instances, for instance, where a child like Shane is reduced to a partial day, whether the school is collecting full reimbursement or not. We have no idea. It would be a good thing to know. And I did need to correct something that I might have left a false impression about. The 704 students we're talking about are students who are receiving only tutorial instruction, generally of 5 hours a week, not in all instances, but usually that's the package. We think the number of students who are in Shane's situation is actually far greater than that.
Well, thank you all very much for coming and sharing your stories. And I especially appreciate that you came in the light of Shane's recent loss and yours. So thank you for making time in the middle of a very sad time. And I'm sure we'll all be thinking of Shane.
Thank you.
We appreciate the opportunity.
Yes, we do.
Thank you very much for bringing the information. Could the department come up for a moment, please? Interim committee days, these meetings are long compared to our hour and 50 minutes, but
She's supposed to bring cookies and milk for us.
Yeah, something. Really, where's my cookies?
Okay, cookies and milk in November in a seventh inning stretch.
Are you going to bake them for us?
Oh. Yes, I will bake you cookies. Mm-hmm. I bet Representative Parrish would bake better cookies than me, though. Welcome. So just a couple of questions that are bouncing off of my head, and I don't know about others. How might we figure out
how to classify this broad spectrum of kids to pick up those not in special ed. And what about the funding piece?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Jan McComb from the Oregon Department of Education, and in trying to anticipate what kind of questions you might have, I brought with me Sarah Drinkwater, our special ed expert, and she can handle all those special ed questions, and Mike Wolfong is our state school fund expert. So sometimes when you hear statements like 5 hours of tutorial in a week, that bleeds into Mike's area, because in our rules, we've decided that 1 hour of tutorial equals a full day of education, and that's been on the books for like 20 years. And so school districts report data to us in kind of these aggregate clumps. Here's a full day student, here's a half day student, and some students are counted hourly. And we don't drill down very much deeper than that. There was a question about what happens if a school district sends a student home early. And I think Mike had a more complete answer than was given. Did you want to talk about that first?
Sure. For the record, Mike Wolfong, Department of Education, School Finance Director. In regards to the question about does the school district continue to receive funding if the student's sent home, in the case where they're tutorial students, the answer is no, because the student's on an hourly basis. So while the student's not in school, the school district does not receive any funding. Okay.
But if the student is solely on that 5 hours of tutoring, And maybe the student doesn't come to the school site at all, is the district getting a full weight for that student for the 5 hours of tutoring a week?
Representative Gelser, the student would be considered part-time. When we use the hourly calculation, it's a part-time calculation, not a full-time program. And so the student would be, for the 5 hours, the department says for 5 hours, if that's receiving that 5 hours per week, that's considered full-time, but it's on an hourly basis. As far as the school district, they can provide more hours of instruction beyond that, and we oftentimes see that. But as far as reporting to the department, we just accept that the 5 hours is considered full-time for the week on a one-on-one situation.
So if I'm a school district and I've reported that I have Shane, and Shane is on tutorial only the 5 hours of home instruction, and he's classified as special ed, if the weight is $4,500 on average, is that district getting $9,000 a year for that 5 hours of home tutoring for the student that brings in a double weight?
Chair Gelser, as far as the funding, if the student would be on the tutorial setting for a year's time, I believe the amount that you're talking about as far as the per year is closer to about $6,500 per general purpose grant per extended ADMW, not the $9,000, but it is a substantial amount of money. Typically, we don't see that. Of the 704 students that were identified as tutorial in our collection, not all of those were special education students. There's a variety of scenarios that we use the tutorial setting, such as, you know, children with cancer, what have you. So there's a variety of scenarios that we do that. And oftentimes it's on a very limited basis. In seldom cases, of the 704 instances, there was 161 ADM for the state. So again, keeping in mind that not all the students were full-time that were identified under tutorial, but the culmination of all the ADM together added up to a full-time.
Okay, so I'm puzzled. How does 5 hours of tutorial equal a full week of school? How does that work?
You want to go? Or?
Chair Gelser, Representative Gorsuch. It's my understanding from my predecessors that whereas the one-on-one situation with the student and the teacher, that financially that amount of focus education, they can't afford to have a one-on-one for every student, and so they came up with a formula that 5 hours a week is considered full-time.
So it's not based on an equivalent of learning, it's based on the cost.
Chair Gelser, Representative Gorsuch, yes, I would say it'd be true.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may weigh in on this a little bit, and I'm certainly not addressing it as we've outlined a couple scenarios here today. We paid privately for some tutoring for our son in between fifth and sixth grade years, and it was, I believe, an hour to an hour, I think it was an hour, once a week. And I'm not equating it to this situation here. However, sure. I will say, not however, and I will add to that, that hour, there was a lot of focused learning that occurred in that hour. I'm not saying it was equal to a school day. I'm just saying when you first mentioned that, the only reason I could empathize with that equation at all is we pay for that time, and the intensity that he received with one person staring him in the eyeballs for an hour was more than sitting in his classroom. Not justifying anything.
Yeah. No, that's good information.
And I would add just one thing as well, is that not only is it very intense, but there's an assumption that there's going to be work done when you go home, and much more than the normal homework assignment. So very, very intense. I did some tutoring for a while, and of course, in my case, I was just much more efficient. And,
well, of course, yes.
That's why it worked so well. So.
So on that home tutoring, though, I think one of the differences between both of these and this narrower set of circumstances that we're looking at, it's not so much tutoring that's supplementing the instruction that's going on all week. It is a replacement for and instead, and maybe different than a student with cancer who for a short period of time is receiving only that 5 hours a week of tutoring. In the rule that creates it that way, that focuses on the financial side rather than the learning side for the student, has there been significant discussion about what happens if that goes on for a student over the course of a year or over the course of 2 years, and how that feeds into our goal of all students graduating from high school in 4 years prepared for college or a career? Is that a conversation that's happening anyplace?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, not that I'm aware of. Our rule talks about the hourly instructional requirements, 990 hours in high school and so on. But that is on school districts. They have to offer a comprehensive curriculum and that number of hours to students. I don't think, and I would want to double check, but I don't think we have the reverse that says students need to actually be there for 990 hours. And so I don't know that any of our rules or any of your legislation speaks to how much instruction a student would get.
Aren't students covered by the compulsory attendance?
They are supposed to be there, Chair Gelser, and we do have truancy laws. And it's my understanding that some districts enforce them and some don't, and it just really varies across the state.
Mm-hmm. So what would happen if a different way of addressing the problem, rather than figuring out how do you figure out how many hours, what if schools, so take a secondary student, a high school student, what if a school district was only reimbursed for the amount of time the student was actually in school? So if there's 7 courses in a high school day and the student is only taking 4, whether that's because they have a behavior issue that sent them out or because they've signed up for 3 open blocks, they got 4/7 funding for the student that was only there for 4/7 of the time. Is that a conversation that could?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I think that is a conversation we are having over at the Department of Education and how that would work. That would be a big policy shift for districts. They would need to know that well in advance so they could budget for that.
Would that pick up this type of, I mean, if we're looking at how do we serve these kids, I'm just wondering, does it make sense for the committee or the departments or others to dive out down into these, you know, whether it's 700 kids or 200 kids, or is it a bigger, I mean, I think there's that connect between the reimbursement and the finance side and the learning side, and what is the payment to the school district for and intended to get at. So I just wonder, as we look at moving forward towards February 1, how do we get the information about who these kids are, and is the strategy to resolve the issue really specific to this situation, or might it be more broadly for the kind of conversation that Representative Springer's group is having about how we distribute state school fund dollars?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Mike can interrupt me if I misstate things, but in order to collect the data that's being requested, we would have to change our rules, change our forms, train school district personnel, flag things differently. School districts would have to
report differently. And so we would need to have that conversation with them to see how that would best be done.
Chair, I'm excited for your conversation. All those seniors that are only taking two classes a year.
If you were a senior, would you only take two classes a year when there's a welding class? I look at these kids that don't sign up, and there's so many great classes to take.
Are there other questions?
Was that, I'm kind of hearing those stories, and I hear you saying you would have to change your rules, change your processes, change your forms, change your training. What recommendations would you have for trying to get at the issue? Because it just seems like there's a little bit of a black hole here where kids are falling into slots that aren't suspension and expulsion, that probably aren't necessarily IEP placement decisions.
So, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I would just hesitate to speculate without talking to Deputy Superintendent Saxton about this huge policy change. To have us think off the top of our heads, it seems really dangerous for us.
Well, and not a policy, not asking for a policy change, but I mean, I think we heard a problem. I'm perplexed at how do we figure out the scope of the problem, and I mean, I think the bottom line at the end of the day, you've got kids that have some significant needs and some significant support needs that also are entitled to an education. And I think you have a kid with a lot of support needs that doesn't go to school. You then end up with an 18-year-old that has a lot of support needs that didn't go to school and now doesn't have a high school diploma. And there aren't a lot of places for that person to land.
That's true.
After that, I don't know if you have suggestions of next steps.
Excellent summary, and maybe they should talk to their leadership on it.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I would also think that we would need to touch bases with the school districts involved to see what their side of the story is and make sure that we're hearing a complete version of events and to see what the best approach moving forward would be.
And I haven't seen OLIS yet, but I believe Youth Rights and Justice put together another number of vignettes, and the request was to not have them be specific, and we didn't want to point out specific districts. The idea was it's something that gets replicated. How do we look at it as a system issue rather than kind of an individual case?
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm happy to take this concern back and take a look at it and ask folks. I know Michael has spent a lot of time thinking about this, and he's probably chomping at the bit to tell you his ideas. So
if we put an update on this on the November agenda, might you be able to come back with some suggestions of what we should do next and if there's something we should be doing in February to help the conversation along?
I think we need to find out who, if it was Representative Springer on that committee, that needs to be just subject of that committee, too, working with ODE that we talk about looking at that.
Representative Springer and then Representative Gorsak.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've just been sitting here thinking, and I certainly apologize for coming in late. I was called out of the room for something in the prior conversation, but it sounds like there's a couple issues going on here, one of which is treatment and the facilitation of a free and appropriate education for at least this particular child and certain populations, and then how we're funding, which is the task force piece that I misspoke earlier about, that I am on, that task force piece. And so I'm seeing two different issues, maybe solutions in two different ways, one of which is this task force needs to be looking how that's funded. Because if we're going to a model of how many hours a kid is in school, the red flags just went up all over the state for the seniors. Mine's a junior in senior year. He better be going more than two classes. But those kids that are only attending only have to attend two or three classes. So I think that there's a whole issue there, and I'm more than willing and happy to take that to this task force and look at that issue for you. Bring back some feedback and certainly anything that maybe the department would want to throw at that. But I'm seeing two issues, and I don't know, maybe everybody disagrees or agrees with that. Because I have some real concerns about that one.
Since Gresham Barlow's in my district partially, I'm going to talk to them and talk to the district so I can also report back in November about that particular case.
Anything else? Anybody else that wants to be heard on this?
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for kind of responding on the fly.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I think we have completed our agenda for the day. We'll see you all in November. And we're adjourned.